Good morning, everyone.
I'd like to welcome you to the first annual NIH conference on building the science of dissemination and implementation in the service of public health. I'm Dara Blackman, the conference co-chair. I'm a policy fellow sponsored by the Society for Research and Child Development working at OBSSR. On behalf of the NIH Office of Behavioral and Social Sciences Research and our co-sponsoring institutes, I wish to extend you a very warm welcome. The planning committee has been working very hard for a year to bring you the very exciting program that we have in store for today. We're simply delighted at the overwhelming response and enthusiasm that we've received for this conference. And now I'd like to introduce to you Dr. David Abrams, the director of the Office of Behavioral and Social Sciences Research. He will provide a welcome and an introduction to today's events. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Abrams.
Thank you, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here and to see the audience. And would like to say that there was huge interest, more than we expected, in this conference, as well as in our series on systems thinking and systems integration. And I think there's some obvious overlap in interests between systems thinking models and dissemination, implementation, community participatory research models. So it's really exciting to see the sort of critical mass gelling in these areas that I think are obviously critical, because as we go from biology and biomedicine and reductionist mechanisms at the genetic and physiologic level, all the way to thinking about societal impacts on health and macroeconomics and global forces, it's very clear that behavior and behavior change has to be central to making an impact on individual, family, and population health. As I've said in some other talks, it's a key bridge, and that behavior essentially bridges biology and human-created society and the natural environment. You can't go around it, you can't jump over it, you can't go under it, you can't duck it. You have to embrace behavior and behavior change at every level if you want to improve health and healthcare in any nation of the world, whether it's developing or developed. So I think from those sort of quick remarks about the big picture, it's very, very exciting for OBSSR as a trans-NIH entity that looks for commonalities and opportunities across diseases, organ system, life stage developmental factors, and other areas of cross-cutting research to promote and support something that really had its germs and support in germs in a positive way, probiotics, I guess. But the germ of support was really with John Kern and David Chambers and others at NCI and NIMH, the National Institute of Mental Health and the National Cancer Institute. But as is often the case, really good ideas gather and diffuse and spread, and we are very happy to not only embrace and support this, but to try to encourage other institutes and centers to collaborate and to participate at every level in this common theme of both what I call the basic science, which is the mechanisms that facilitate or inhibit dissemination, implementation, and policy adoption that leads to true population level change at a meaningful level of impact, as well as the applied science of dissemination, which is getting into the implementation, things like consumer demand and direct-to-consumer motivating and marketing, reaching underserved low-income and minority populations, and really, again, changing behavior, not only at the individual level, but I think the ultimate goal of all of this is to change population-level curves, especially in the big diseases that affect large numbers of people. And where I think we show that behavior and behavior change can be a very powerful force. There are several examples of that. I think ones that we perhaps take for granted but ought to be emphasized are, I don't think it's an inconsequential feat to have cut smoking in half in less than 40 years. So essentially, in one generation, you can change a whole population's health behavior, and we've done it in tobacco through myriad interventions. And if you actually even look at the HIV/AIDS epidemic in America, within 15 to 20 years of the outbreak of the epidemic and that huge rise in incidence of HIV/AIDS has literally been cut in half in America. That's incidence, which clearly has to do with changing behavior and risk-taking and so forth. So two huge examples that behavior and behavior change technology can work. If we use the rules of human behavior, we can change behavior on a large scale. And we have to combine multi-level interventions and multiple systems that we have to impact upon, literally from cells to behavior to families and neighborhoods to community-based to policy-level interventions. And then we have to figure out how those all work and how to optimize, tailor, and target them for large-scale population impact. So those are some of the rationales for why now. Why is this critically important to the NIH right now? And I think it's obvious. We really are not doing as good a job of putting what we know into practice and policy with respect to what we could do to change population health behaviors in large numbers, especially for the chronic diseases. Both persistent problems that we've struggled with for decades, like eliminating health disparities, or continuing to work on tobacco, which is by no means gone just because we've cut it in half and had some successes in reducing the medical sequelae of tobacco use, and emerging and new challenges such as the well-known obesity epidemic and the downstream consequences of that in terms of type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, cancers, and other sequelae of obesity. So for all those reasons, this is a critical time, and perhaps not the least important is we can do something right now. We need to have a technology and a basic science and a stronger science of methodology, of implementation, efficiency, effectiveness, and cost effectiveness in ways that I think various fields, various technologies like informatics and communication, and statistical and other sophisticated analyses, computer modeling, are all coming together to give us a phenomenal amount of new tools. To me, this is sort of like the discovery of the electron microscope changing the way one looked at the cellular level. I think informatics and communications technologies, knowledge management, and systems thinking and systems integration are going to be the mechanisms and tools that will transform behavioral, social, and population sciences in much the same way as systems thinking, mathematical modeling has in fact and is transforming biology into what we now call routinely systems biology. So what I'd like to see in this conference is this sort of critical mass of strengthening the science of dissemination and implementation, moving towards a larger systems integrative model, contributing to that. And so we have a strong science of systems behavioral and population change that's analogous to the strengths in the science of systems biology that's really scaling up the complexity of how cells interact and how genes and environment interact. So I think it's no coincidence that this conference has been co-sponsored by a number of NIH agencies, particularly the National Cancer Institute, National Institute of Mental Health, National Institute of Drug Abuse, National Institute of Alcoholism and Alcohol Problems, and the National Institute of Child Health, NICHD. We also would like to thank the planning committee for putting this wonderful conference together, co-chaired by Dara Blackman and Jerry Flanzer. Jerry is from NIDA but is on detail to OBSSR, but I think the two of them have done a wonderful job, assisted by John Kerner, Kara Hall, David Chambers, Chris Gordon, Pete Delaney, Tom Hilton, and Valerie Malholmes. From these various NIH institutes. So again, we're trying to bring cross-cutting themes together. Also, I'd like to note that we're not only interested in collaborating within NIH, but also various other agencies, CDC, ARC, SAMHSA, Robert Wood Johnson, and other NGOs are also very strongly interested in this area. For example, I know recently that Robert Wood Johnson's been talking about various ways to strengthen research on direct-to-consumer advertising and marketing and understanding consumer behavior in the service of reaching, motivating, and getting large numbers of individuals to change. So there are common areas across other NIH agencies as well as other non-government agencies, and I really strongly and am very excited about the possibilities of working together and finding complementary areas of research so that various aspects of research can be fully supported. So this all fits with OBSSR's new strategic plan, which is essentially a key part of this is to focus on interdisciplinary research, on systems integration and systems thinking, on strengthening the science of dissemination and implementation, both as a basic science in terms of the mechanisms underlying successful dissemination, implementation, and policy change, as well as in applied research on the tools, technologies, and techniques for efficient and effective reach, delivery, maintenance delivery, and impact. And you'll hear lots more about that from Russ Glasgow and others that I think have a really excellent model of beginning to look at the key parameters that one needs to fully articulate an evidence-based approach and a data-oriented approach to dissemination and implementation and population-based change. So for all those reasons, I'm really thrilled to be speaking before you, to have such a large audience. We did have to close this conference out. You know, we had over 700 or 800 applicants for 500 slots. Some of the empty seats are probably because we then decided to webcast this because of all the extra interest, and often what that means is that some NIH staff who register for this conference decide to look at it in the convenience of their office as a webcast rather than directly come here, even though they might have registered. So they're actually watching, they're just not in the seats. So we are very excited at the interest in this. I think Dr. Zahuni, when he talks about the three Ps, just to finally bring this sort of together, has been talking a lot about the urgency and the pressing need to look at the unsustainable rising costs of healthcare, the unacceptable divides that are sometimes growing in terms of disparities in healthcare delivery. The fact that America in the national scene is not doing as well with its healthcare dollar as the UK or other countries are doing. And the fact that really in the sort of global world, we're not maintaining our competitiveness on the national marketplace because of the enormous burden of costs of healthcare in the United States. Couple that with aging baby boomers and we have the kind of perfect storm of which I think things like Hurricane Katrina are another symbol of what happens when you really don't look at the social, the interconnectedness of communities, the trust issues, essentially the psychosocial and policy issues that underlie sustaining community capacity and providing resistance and tools to maximize health behavior, especially in those communities who lack resources and where more is needed to understand how to support those folks at the local area. So all of that, I think, again, comes around to making this a very exciting time for NIH to be putting a lot more effort and interest in how do we take what we know today and put it into a practice efficiently and effectively to impact within one generation large numbers and shift those huge population curves the way we've done successfully with tobacco up to now and with HIV/AIDS up to now, although there's tons more work to do in all of the areas of chronic disease. So with that, I'd like to welcome you. I'm very excited to do this, and I'd like to take just a minute to introduce our first keynote speaker, and we're very honored to have Jeremy Grimshaw, who is an MD, PhD with a British training, which is near and dear to my heart. The sun still doesn't set on the British Empire, but most of the members of that empire are probably located in countries other than the UK or places like South Africa, where I come from now. So it's great to have him here. He has his doctorate from the University of Edinburgh, his MD, and he was trained as a family physician prior to undertaking a PhD in health services research at the University of Aberdeen. He moved to Canada in 2002, and his research focuses on the evaluation of interventions to disseminate and implement evidence-based practice. Dr. Grimshaw is the director of clinical epidemiology program at the Ottawa Health Research Institute, director of the Center for Best Practices at the Institute of Population Health at the University of Ottawa, and director of the Canadian Cochrane Network. He is chair of the Health Knowledge Transfer and Update Committee and is a full professor in the Department of Medicine at the University of Ottawa. So with that, it gives me great pleasure to introduce Jeremy to you today, and I look forward to a stimulating day of discussion and interaction on dissemination and implementation research. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm delighted to be here. I'd particularly like to thank Dara and Jerry and the organizing committee for their invitation to attend this. I would really like to congratulate the NIH on both the organization of this conference and particularly making it an annual conference, and also the recent FOA for dissemination and implementation research. I'm going to call it D&I research because otherwise we won't get through the morning. But D&I research is a relatively new field. And I think the NIH funding is an important milestone in the recognition of this field, and is sending a clear signal to researchers both with and funders and the healthcare community both in the US but also more globally. So I would really congratulate the NIH and sort of hope that they will be able to sustain these efforts over a period of time. My disclaimers. Steve Wolfe, in January 2006, wrote a wonderful op-ed in the Washington Post, and the headline was "All Breakthrough, No Follow-Through." Steve was arguing that if we continue to invest in discovery research but do not place equal weight upon dissemination and implementation research, we will be, in fact, wasting our dollars on discovery research, and that we've reached a breakthrough point. We've made such great advances in discovery research that we really now do need to move into an era where we're giving as much focus to dissemination and implementation research for the benefits of patients. I would argue that much of the, I have no idea what the total global budget on biomedical and health research is, but let's say it's $100 billion, is wasted because of dissemination and implementation failures. One of the most consistent findings of health services research is that healthcare systems and healthcare professionals fail to deliver the quality of care that they aspire to. We have lots of evidence with non-emergent knowledge like diabetic retinopathy screening, like cardiovascular risk factor management and diabetes, that basically healthcare systems fail to deliver very effective and very efficient treatment options. Richard Grawl is a psychologist in the Netherlands and has been one of the leaders of dissemination and implementation research in Europe. And in 1997, he laid down a challenge to all of us in this area. He said that evidence-based medicine should be complemented by evidence-based implementation. In other words, if we're thinking about how to do dissemination implementation, we should be trying to build and use a robust research evidence base to make sure that we don't waste our resources, the resources we have for dissemination implementation. He also noted, though, that in his experience in various healthcare settings, most of the approaches to changing clinical practice that were adopted were based on the beliefs of the actors in the room rather than scientific evidence. Lots of people are very sure they know how to change behavior and improve quality, and very few of them actually refer back to evidence to support that. And again, he was challenging us that if we are in those rooms where we're discussing how we do D&I, one of the questions we should be asking is there any research out there that will help us understand how to do this better, that can inform our efforts? So one of the issues is that sometimes people get a bit confused about what dissemination implementation research is. And I would just argue that the process of dissemination implementation is a human enterprise that can be studied like any other human enterprise and can be studied to understand and improve our approaches to D&I. So dissemination implementation research is a scientific study of the determinants, processes, and outcomes of D&I. There are many, many different questions and issues that we face in the field, and here is just a list of some of the areas that I think are part of the umbrella of dissemination implementation research. And these include things like knowledge synthesis, I think we have to learn how we can decrease the noise-to-signal ratio by focusing our efforts on areas where there are clear population benefits of the interventions we're trying to promote. We need to understand the evolution of research evidence to make sure we have reasonable expectations of this. We need to know, do routine assessments of where the knowledge-to-action gaps are, work out how we can start to assess the bias and facilitators to D&I, how we develop interventions, how we evaluate those, and underlying all of this is some very fundamental research in terms of the development of D&I theory and D&I research methods. What I want to do today is focus upon my experience of particularly doing work and thinking about evaluations of the effectiveness and efficiency of D&I strategies and also issues in development of D&I theory. But I think during the day we'll have to actually sort of talk about or potentially many of these different aspects. So moving on to sort of evaluation of the effectiveness and efficiency of D&I strategies, what I'd like to do is summarize what the current available evidence is and then highlight what I think are some of the key methodological and conceptual weaknesses within that evidence base as a way of saying how do we do this better in the future? What are the things that we should pay more attention to as we're planning new studies? Now, I would argue that rigorous evaluations, mainly randomized controlled trials, will provide the best evidence of the effectiveness of different dissemination implementation interventions because the effects of the interventions to date are modest. We have very limited understanding of the likely confounders, so if we use non-randomized approaches, I wouldn't even know what I should potentially be correcting for if I wanted to try and use observational approaches. And perhaps most importantly, there are substantial opportunity costs if ineffective and inefficient dissemination and implementation strategies are used. If we use designs that are subject to bias and end up with results that say we think a certain intervention is effective and that gets taken up by the healthcare system, they are wasting their resources for dissemination and implementation. What we need to do is have some confidence that if we're going to introduce use a dissemination and intervention strategy, it will lead to significant improvements in the care that is provided. This is my personal opinion. It's open for debate, and I'm sure we'll have some discussion during the day. But if you accept my personal opinion for the time being, how much evidence is out there? I head up something called the Cochrane Effective Practice and Organization of Care Group. We're the Cochrane group that aims to undertake systematic reviews of interventions to improve healthcare systems and healthcare delivery, including different professional interventions. How do we provide CME? What happens if you provide audit feedback to healthcare professionals? Financial incentives, what happens if you change the way we pay professionals, organizational interventions? What happens if we change the setting of care, the professionals involved in that care, how those professionals work together, and regulatory interventions? We started this group about 13 years ago. When we did, we thought we'd identify about 300 studies and we'd have probably finished our work by now. In fact, what we've identified is a register of over 5,000 primary studies. And we include both randomized controlled trials, usually cluster randomized trials, but also well-designed quasi-experiments, controlled before and after studies and interrupted time series. Our reviewers have done 42 reviews and are working on a further 39 protocols. And we're working with about 300 researchers globally. So one of the first messages is that although this is a relatively new field of research, there is a very substantial evidence base out there that we should be trying to learn from as we want to move the field forward. One of the things that we've been doing as a potential D&I activity is working with our Health Technology Assessment Agency in Canada to summarize 50 systematic reviews that are judged to be the most likely, highest quality, and most up-to-date to help support one of their programs. And the URL will be on the final slide as well, so if people want to catch it, they can. And what I want to do now is just highlight some of the results from those reviews. So here's a list of reviews that we've actually summarized. And what I'll do is just focus on the bolded ones. Printed educational materials. This is a Cochrane review that will be published in the first edition of 2008. When we talk about printed educational materials, we think about the distribution of published or printed recommendations for care. So sending guidelines out in the post, publishing them in JAMA or another major journal. There are actually 21 studies, 6 randomized controlled trials and 15 non-randomized studies. And if you look across those studies, you can find that the median effect across the six randomized trials was an absolute improvement of 4.3%. In other words, have it when you distributed guidelines, your appropriateness with care went up by about 4.3%. And in one study, there's a deterioration of care, and in one of the largest effect we saw was about a 9.6% improvement in care. I have previously published reviews that said this intervention doesn't work, and that was largely because of the methods that we were using. I think this review says or suggests that this is an intervention that we may not want to ignore at this point in time. This is a relatively cheap and feasible intervention. So what we do need to do is actually more research to understand, you know, what the real effects are. I think there's a lot of uncertainty about the benefits at this point in time. If we move on to educational outreach, you are now the third audience in the world to have seen the results of a new updated Cochrane review that will be published in edition 4, 2007. Educational outreach is the method that was promoted particularly by Jerry Vaughan and Steve Sumerai, using the methods of particularly drug companies to try and get evidence-based messages across. And the idea is you'd have a use of a trained person who'd meet with the providers in their practice settings to give information on the intent of changing the provider's practice, largely using social persuasion techniques. There are now 69 randomized controlled trials of educational outreach. If you look at prescribing behaviors, across 17 randomized trials, we see an average effect of about 5% improvement with appropriate prescribing guidelines, with an interquartile range from 3% to 6.5%. If you look at other behaviors, across 17 trials, a 6% improvement with an interquartile range from 3.6% to 16%. Most of the studies included in this are two-arm trials looking at educational outreach versus control. I'm not sure we need any further trials of educational outreach versus control. I'm not sure they're going to give us any new information. Virtually none of the trials, though, tell us how to optimize educational outreach. Does it make a difference if you visit once or twice or three times? Does it make a difference if you have a credible visitor versus a less credible visitor? Does it make a difference if your educational outreach visitor develops a long-term relationship with the practitioners that they're challenging? So at this point in time, I think we have enough evidence about the likely effects of kind of one-off educational outreach and visits, and we should probably make, we've got enough evidence to think about a policy decision. Although it doesn't sound much, you can actually, 4.8% improvement in prescribing can be efficient given the cost of drugs. But it means that for future research, we need to ask different questions. We move on to audit and feedback, providing summary of clinical performance over healthcare over a specified period of time. There are 118 randomized controlled trials of audit and feedback. The median effect across 68 comparisons was about 5%, with the interquartile range from plus 3 to 11%. Larger effects were seen if baseline compliance was low. We don't need any more two-arm trials of audit and feedback. What we need to do is trials that will actually test different ways of delivering audit and feedback across a range of behaviors to work out when are we more likely to get an 11% improvement, and that may make it worthwhile, and when are we likely to get only a 3% improvement. We need to change the way we're doing research in the field to advance our knowledge base. Further two-arm trials of audit and feedback will largely not be worthwhile. Another comment that is commonly made is that multifaceted interventions are more effective than single interventions. We were able to study this in a systematic review of guideline dissemination implementation strategies. We reviewed 235 randomized controlled trials and quasi experiments. And if multifaceted interventions are more likely to be effective than single interventions, you might expect a dose response curve. As you go from single component to two component to three component to four component interventions, your effect sizes get larger. Hopefully you can see from this, these are the single intervention components, two component interventions, three, four. There's no obvious dose response curve. Yeah? This was a great challenge when we did this. Lots of people found it very hard to believe, but we've actually replicated it now across a number of other studies. And I think Laura Levitin from the Robert Wood Johnson was the person who most eloquently described what the problem probably is here, which is that when you look at why people put different interventions together, there is no rhyme or reason. They just seem to throw anything at the doctors or the nurses that they can think of. So instead of doing a careful, if you want to use the analogy of a systems approach, they just throw everything at it and hope something will stick. And what is happening, what this evidence base would say at this point in time, most of the ways the researchers are putting together multifaceted interventions are not increasing their effectiveness. And they're probably wasting resources in terms of using them. So again, we have to think more carefully about testing multifaceted interventions and how we put them together, how we build them, so that they are more like, so we can a priori expect that the effects will be at least additive, if not synergistic. If you do systematic reviews in this area, you also find an abundance of problems with the previous evaluations. Some of them are technical, some of them are conceptual, and some of them are about reporting. In terms of technical issues, in many cluster randomized trials and cluster allocated quasi-experiments, the clustering is ignored, resulting in studies that have small numbers of units. The average number of units per arm in the studies I've just talked about is about 7. People often will power their studies to have unrealistic effect sizes. In general, we're looking at effect sizes that go between 5 and 10%. We haven't found any penicillins that will dramatically improve our improved quality. And so, you know, I think we really have to think about powering our studies appropriately. The concern is we normally say, well, we have 20 hospitals in our local area we might be able to randomize, and therefore we'll find out what effect size we can predict with 20 hospitals. What this requires is for us to be far more ambitious and say, let's ask the question right. Let's work out what is a reasonable effect size to expect, and let's power these studies appropriately. And people like Jeff Horber with the Oxford Vermont Perinatal Trials Group have done trials where they've randomized 300 to 400 perinatal units across the country. We need to build structures that allow us to think at a sufficient ambitious level to make sure that we're actually doing these studies well. There are statistical problems because often at the time of analysis, many people ignore the fact that they've actually got clustering in their data. And so they will often end up assuming that or concluding their results are positive, when in fact, if the correct statistical analysis was done, it would be showing no effect result. These are technical issues. We're getting better over time. More recent trials are less likely to suffer from these problems. But for people thinking about moving into the area, these are things that are very easy to fix. They're slightly scary because they'll always increase your sample size. If you want to use quasi-experiments, interrupted time series are usually too short and incorrectly analyzed. So they don't take into account things like the autocorrelated nature of the data. Technical issues that with a good statistician and methodologist you should be able to fix. At the design level, the majority of studies are two-arm trials, normally intervention versus control. I no longer think these are particularly helpful. They say, in this context, this seemed to work. It's very hard to think about how we generalize from this context to others, although other speakers may talk about that later. But I think we need to increasingly think about multi-arm trials or factorial designs that actually allow us to test head-to-head comparisons of different interventions or head-to-head comparisons of different ways of delivering the same intervention. If you look at the intervention, there's little rationale provided for the choice of intervention. In our guidelines review, less than a third provided any theoretical rationale about why they chose their intervention. If you read the report, you could have concluded that they woke up one day and said, oh, we'll trial, audit, and feedback today. No suggestion that there was a thoughtful process around that choice of intervention. Less than 10 explicitly tested a theory. At least one of those, I think the intervention tester, didn't test the theory that they claimed it was. There is insufficient feasibility testing, so interventions go into the field before they're ready for real-time use. Economic evaluation is largely ignored. Healthcare systems have limited resources for dissemination and implementation, and therefore the arguments for economic evaluation, if anything, are more pressing than they are for economic evaluation of clinical interventions. There's been little efforts to explore causal mechanisms of any observed changes, and in the reporting there's insufficient details of context, intervention, and methods. I'm going to skip the next slide because these are largely what I've already highlighted. One of the things I would encourage, though, is that we should think more about full reporting and particularly thinking about publication of study protocols. I routinely publish the protocols of the majority of studies I'm involved with, and you now have open access sources like the Biomed series and others who will actually publish your protocol and be happy to do so. There's a new Biomed journal called Implementation Science that Brian Mittman is an editor on, and that is particularly devoted to trying to publish a lot of this work early on. looking at my time. One of the things that I think we need to think about is a more thoughtful approach to how we develop different implementation interventions. And the UK MRC produced a framework for evaluating complex interventions because they recognized that as a funder, they had problems and their researchers had problems getting things funded. And they highlighted that too often people went to a definitive randomized controlled trial with very little preparation work and argued we need to give at least as much effort to theory building, modeling of interventions, feasibility studies before we get to a definitive trial. And again, this is a framework that's been very useful for me personally and has shifted our research to make sure we're looking as much at the theory and modeling sizes as well as the definitive trials in the work that we do. I want to move quickly on to building theory. I think one of the fundamental problems in dissemination implementation at this point in time is we don't have a coherent theoretical basis for understanding the determinants of behavior and the likely mechanisms of behavior change. One of our challenges, though, is that we're often working at multi-levels, and so different types of theory would be relevant to interventions at different levels. One of the other challenges is there's too many theories out there. I think we need more theory, but less theories. There are multiple theories and frameworks of individual and organizational behavior change. Most of these are descriptive and normative rather than predictive. Few have been operationalized in detail that allows someone to use them in planning an intervention in any way. Many have not been prospectively evaluated. Few have been tested head-to-head. So I think we need predictive theories that incrementally improve the likelihood of successful implementation and also a really rigorous approach to evaluating different kinds of theories. One of the ways that we've tried to cut down on the global number of theories to work out which ones are relevant is to particularly focus at the level of the individual healthcare practitioner and argue that given clinical practice as a form of human behavior, we can explore the applicability of predictive theories of human behavior from other settings. There are other groups that are focusing at the team level or the organizational level, and at some point in time, we're going to have to bring all of these together. So we've focused on mid-level theories that have standardized measures. One of the real issues is how you actually measure these constructs. They've been empirically tested somewhere else. They explain behavior in terms of factors that are amenable to change, and they include non-volitional factors. And if you do that, you find all of a sudden this list of several thousand theories very dramatically shrinks into probably tens, maybe twenties of theories. So let's start where there's at least some good evidence base that we should be testing these theories at this point in time. We can build theories using rigorous methods if we don't have good theories at this point in time in other settings. We have used four different approaches to testing theory. The first are a validation study. Let's do the first in healthcare professional test of this theory. What happens if we try and apply a theory that's been developed for our individual behaviors and we see whether it predicts professional behavior the same way? Then starting through typology of taxonomy studies, where we're using specific theories as a framework to investigate factors associated with particular behaviors. And in this setting, testing them head-to-head under which are the best social cognition theories to actually look at within this area. Moving on to more rigorous evaluations of theoretically based interventions, and also embedding theory-based process evaluations alongside any randomized controlled trials. Explicitly hypothesize what mechanism we think we're changing, and then testing alongside the trial, are we changing and affecting that mechanism, and do we get behavior change? Where might this lead us to? I'm going to present two slides on stages to change literature, and I know this is a very common, strongly held model, and I'm going to argue that potentially, there's still a debate raging, but actually what's happened with stages to change should happen in other areas. So the first slide is a systematic review of done by the UK Health Technology Assessment Programme that looked at 37 trials of interventions using stages to change models. And their conclusion was overall there appears to be little evidence to suggest that stage-based interventions are more effective compared to non-stage-based interventions, no intervention or usual care. In other words, someone has subjected these studies to 37 rigorous randomized controlled trials of whether this intervention works. Those authors and the theory developers should be applauded. Michael West was a little bit more inflammatory, and there is an ongoing debate about this. But he had an editorial in Addiction that said, there are serious problems with the model, many of which have been well articulated. However, its popularity continues largely unabated. This editorial simply argues that the problems with this model are so serious that it's held back advances in the field of health promotion, and despite its intuitive appeal to many practitioners, it should be discarded. It is now time for change. I think a success of dissemination implementation research is when we test theories to destruction. And if we test them to destruction, it provides new information. If they hold up, it's very profound. If we find that they are lacking in certain areas, we can use those to build new theoretical perspectives. And we have to think very critically about any theories we want to use and apply similar sort of rigor in our approach and critique of them. So, summary. Dissemination implementation research is a relatively new field in health research. I would argue it's inherently interdisciplinary, and really sort of back up David's comments. I think a wide range of disciplines need to be engaged. You need clinical audiences, health services research, behavioral and organizational, design and engineering, methodologists, and I'm probably missing out a few flavors, and I apologize. We also need a broad range of forms of inquiry. I've highlighted issues around testing of interventions and testing of theory, but there are many other legitimate forms of inquiry that we need at this point in time that will use a much more diverse range of different methodological approaches. There is a substantial evidence base on the effects of different dissemination implementation interventions. The good news is that it's possible to change healthcare provider behavior. When I started in this field about 15 years ago, there were editorials in The Lancet and the BMJ saying this was completely a waste of time. You can't change how doctors practice. We can. However, current evidence base provides little practical guidance for healthcare systems about which interventions to use and how to optimize them. And I think future evaluative efforts need to focus on better and more transparent intervention development and more creative design to enhance the informativeness of studies. And there's a substantial development of the theory and methods of D&I research that we need. That's my email. If you want to contact EPOC, that's our email. If you want the URL for the overview of views, that's URL. Thank you very much. This one? Oh. Sorry, could you put up the last slide they're saying?
Maybe we'll take just one or two questions while the panel is getting set up, and then we'll go straight into the panel, which will be a form of discussion as well. Does anybody have just a quick question? Yes, go ahead. If you can just use the mic there.
This is not my field, so if this is an ignorant question, you'll have to excuse it. I was struck by the similarity in the amount of change from all the different interventions, and particularly that they were not additive. It's known that certain people are amenable to change quickly, the so-called early adapters, and some people aren't amenable to change at all. So it leads to my question, which is, these are short-term studies. What happens if you do a longitudinal study of change in practice, whichever one you choose, over a longer period of time?
You find that over a longer period, you get small improvements year on year in the quality of care that are provided in certain areas. I think the policy issues are from a healthcare system perspective, when policymakers are confronted with the idea that 30 to 40% of patients don't get effective treatments, and 20 to 25% of patients may get treatments that are harmful or obsolete, they're not prepared to wait for for that natural evolution of the evidence base. And so I think the issue about for the D&I research agenda is, how do we accelerate this so we get a better year-on-year gain than we would do otherwise with the secular changes?
Nancy, that'll just be the last question, then we'll
move
on to the
panel. Yeah, I have a quick question, which is, you say dissemination and implementation research, it rolls off your tongue and it comes really quickly. What do you see as the distinction between the two, or are they the same?
The area of terminology is just terrible. We did a study of 30 research funders and found 31 different terms for this. In Canada, you'd call it knowledge translation. In the UK, probably implementation research. I think ultimately, I think trying to make too fine a distinction is a waste of time. We kind of have an idea about what we're trying to get at. And you know, if you in the NIH want to call it dissemination implementation research, I don't care. Yeah, I kind of know that, you know, I get a sense about what you want to do, and I feel very comfortable with that. And starting to get into very minor quibbles about, well, what about this flavor versus that flavor of research, I'm not sure is that helpful. It may be over a 30-year period that we develop sub-school, sub-field, but at this point in time, I think the field is so wide open and so underdeveloped that we should just sort of not get too bogged down about those issues.
Please join me in thanking Dr. Grimshaw again. And now I'm going to turn it over to David Chambers, who is the moderator for our first panel this morning.
Thank you. So what we tried to do is pack in as much as we possibly could in this day, which has the unintended consequence of not necessarily allowing as much time for questions among this broad group. What I believe you do have, hopefully everyone has, are index cards. That you can actually, as all of the different speakers are talking across the three morning panels, that you can write down whatever questions you have. There should be boxes, I think, that right at the exit. They're being held up as we speak, that you can deposit the questions relevant to that particular panel in. And then what we want to do is use the hour following lunch as the breakout sessions, where we're going to have further discussions about all of the good ideas and facts, everything presented, the research presented within these presentations. So that's my little orientation thing. What we have here is basically an effort to give you, to go from what Jeremy had said about the hundreds and hundreds of theories, to go down to, say, three or four. And really talk about the research that the three panelists have been engaged in that has really tried to use those theories, those models, as the underpinnings of the work that they've done. So the first speaker we have is Russ Glasgow from Kaiser Permanente in Colorado. His focus has been on patient-centered health behavior change, technology, mediated interventions, and self-management. Over 300 published articles on a lot of topics ranging across behavioral medicine, most well-known for his work with the REAIM model, which he's going to focus on right now. So, Russ.
Well, thank you, David. And I'd like to thank all the planning group for the opportunity to participate in this this exciting event. And I'm even more excited to hear that said this was the first annual one. So that's I think that's an accomplishment itself. I want to begin by a slight disclaimer, starting off the theories panel, in that I need to disabuse you that REAIM itself is not a theory per se. It's a practical framework that my colleagues and I who have developed it have found helpful to focus on some of the key issues that are necessary for successful, use the D&I abbreviation also, and to help us focus our attention on what's necessary to have impactful long-term public health impact. What I'll do in the brief time available to me today is to just set the stage a little bit, tell you why we developed REAIM. I'll go over some of the five key essential components to it, and then just give you a glimpse in the time that's available of what some of the current and future, we hope, applications of REAIM are, because it continues to evolve over time. I'm going to talk about four things just to give you the background. Note that the word context appears in all of these, and I think that's one of the take-home messages I'd like to leave you with. But I'd like to have you think about the interventions that we study. And one of the arguments that I have is that often the types of programs that we developed, we need to be more thoughtful initially about their characteristics. You can read the things here better than I can, but often the interventions or the programs that we develop are so intensive and they're not sufficiently articulated or packaged to be able to be used in real-world settings. The second factor I'd like to have you think about has to do with the settings in which we want to have these programs implemented or disseminated to. And I think the key issue here is the notion of competing demands. Paul Nutting may talk a little bit more about that, but it's the fact that these settings are quite different than those in which we often evaluate the programs, and that the resources and the time in particular are incredibly limited there. The third, we usually don't think about research design itself as being a barrier to implementation, but often many of the designs that we use are found by clinicians to not be relevant to the particular situations in which they are. And the some of the key issues here, I think, have to do with representativeness at several levels. I'll come back to this notion of levels in a little while. But I think that they don't inform practical questions that decision makers and potential adopters have, as you see on the bottom half of this slide, issues about what's the cost of implementing them, and particularly issues related to sustainability. The fourth type of factor that I think is important is really the fit, or how do these first three things all work together. And because of this notion of the incompatibility or the fit here, what we find is that one of the most common things when we look at real-world implementation is that programs don't work, and the reason is that they aren't able to be implemented as they were designed. To try and put these things together, I have a figure here that my colleague Paul Estabrooks and I have adapted from some important systems work that Alan Best and colleagues have done in Canada. And just to walk you through this quickly, to give you this context for the way that I think about this field, is that, again, we have the program over here, but an important point is in the program is there are probably some theoretically important essential elements, but we test an entire program, okay, in a particular setting, packaged in a particular way. In the setting, there's a real levels notion here in that within the setting, there are various levels, and there are particular program delivery staff that are responsible for implementing the program. And then down here, as I went through, we have the research design. What's maybe more important than these various elements is their interactions or the linkages between them. I've already talked about fit, but I think one of the key issues that we find in this type of research is the important need for principles of community-based participatory research and a partnership here. And then the notion of, rather than there being one perfect or optimal design, the notion of the design being appropriate for the question about the stage of research and the intervention that's involved. Well, if this is a brief background, let me now move into to REAIM and how this fits with this framework and kind of the status of where I see the field. We developed REAIM to address a couple key issues. One of them, this notion of context that I hope I've illustrated to you. And secondly, to give equal attention to external validity. Not to ignore internal validity, but at least to give some equal attention to issues of external validity. The second point is that we wanted to focus more on the setting level issues that I talked about there, rather than just the final end user there, but these notions that come from diffusion of innovation and other theories there. And third, the intent of the REAIM framework is that it could be used for the three points listed there. One, to proactively inform the design of interventions so you can focus on these various components. Second, to provide a guide for a decision, particularly if we see more trials of the type that Dr. Grimshaw was talking about, where we have some head-to-head comparisons or we have choices among different evidence-based interventions. And then finally, to suggest some reporting criteria focusing on issues that are frequently ignored, but I, my colleagues and I feel are important for public health impact. As you may have guessed, if you're not familiar, REAIM is an acronym. Stands for Reach, Effectiveness, Adoption, Implementation, and Maintenance. Let me just walk you quickly through what the various definitions and give you a very quick example illustrating what some of the important issues are in each of these elements. reaches the first one, we define this as the number, percent, and the representativeness, very importantly, the representativeness of the individuals, these maybe patients or the end users, consumers who participate. A quick example, as you can see there, is, say, of people who were eligible, 65% of patients invited to a group medical visit attended. And a quick look at the characteristics, as we often find, some of those who are most at risk or have health inequities might be more likely, or the Latinos were less likely to participate in this example. What are the key issues? The key issue here is the program really reaching those who are at highest risk, or those that most in need? And I think an implication that we often don't think enough about is the framing, the social marketing, and the recruitment efforts that are a key part of the program, and I think form an important part of the context. Second component of REAIM, also focusing on what we traditionally call the outcomes, is effectiveness. And by this, we mean both the temporally appropriate outcomes, and I think we need to have greater theoretical thinking about what to expect over what period of time, particularly when we're talking about dissemination research. But in addition, we've argued that we need to have a broader framework in implementation research. And in addition to the key dependent variable, that we also need to focus on some common metrics on quality of life impacts, and also to learn from a lot of the literature that's been out there, to also assess potential adverse outcomes. A key or a quick example here is a telephone outreach program, say, that may be found to increase cancer screening rates, okay, and importantly, but did not have any adverse effects on quality of life, or not doing less in terms of the notion of opportunity cost in other important outcomes. What are some of the key issues here with effectiveness? Well, one is, I think this is a place that we can help with greater specification and making our theory more transparent through the use of a logic model to think about, again, what's temporally appropriate over times. I'd argue that the quality of life issue provides a common metric for comparing across areas, and also this notion of anticipating potential unintended consequences. Moving to the other REAIM factors or areas here, adoption is moving up to the setting level now, and it actually is itself a multi-level concept, and it talks about both the setting or the organization which a program takes place, but also the staff, the clinicians who deliver a program, or the interventionist. Again, a quick example that I think you can read there, and one thing that we look at here is the representativeness of adoption across different types of staff. What are some of the key issues here? One of them, and one of our mantras, is to look at the denominator of all of those people, all of those settings, and all of the people that are clinicians within a setting, rather than just on the numerator of those that actually participate. The I is for implementation. This also focuses on the setting level, and particularly the delivery staff who are delivering a program. Key issue here is consistency, the time, some of the economic issues. How long does it take to deliver a program? What are the characteristics of people that successfully can? And very importantly, again concurrent with Dr. Grimshaw, the cost of a program. Quick example here is that as part of a multi-component smoking cessation program, patients were asked about two-thirds of the time about how long it took, but as we often find, there was inconsistency across different staff in terms of how regularly they were offering or following the protocol, if you will. Again, the key issue, I think, for implementation has to do with consistency. Consistency of delivering different aspects of the program, consistency across delivery agents, and consistency across time. I don't have time now, maybe in the discussion we'll talk about, but often you see programs adapt or evolve over time, and I think that's an issue there, as well as this last one about the balance between fidelity to an original program and appropriate adaptation to local setting. The final re-aim component is what we call maintenance, and that has reference both at the individual level. I'll focus just on the importance of attrition here. And the longer the program goes, often the more challenge attrition seems to be. But it also has references at the setting level, and by that we mean to what extent does the program continue as it was initially implemented over time, or is it discontinued, as we often see in a traditional funding setup, or in fact is it modified or sustained over time? Another example for you there. I think the key issue here has to do with the impact of attrition on results. And at all levels, I think one of the lessons we've learned is that, but maybe particularly for this notion here, long-term maintenance is the value of mixed methods or and qualitative approaches to help us understand some of the reasons behind what are the processes involved. A summary slide here to help us remember that the important thing about re-aim, I think, is that these various components need to fit together. The overall goal is to try and produce a total public health, a large public health impact, but we need to do that. We can't focus only on one or two of the dimensions, but we need a common emphasis on focusing on all of the dimensions. Let me give you a few examples of how re-aim has recently been used, in addition to our own group. One way that it's been used is the CDC has issued a recent program, and they're using it with state-based programs now to evaluate programs and help their obesity programs to focus on long-term impact. It's been used by the Wise Woman program for low-income women, and particularly nice examples there, both qualitative and qualitative interventions. And then finally, Robert Wood Johnson has used it as part of a request for proposals there with some national primary care-based research networks. Where we're going in the future with re-aim is to include greater focus on health disparities with this notion of representativeness of who participates and who benefits, specific inclusion of cost and cost-effectiveness components, this notion of different interventionists, what are the characteristics of people that can deliver program, and finally, putting together the various re-aim components to produce an overall composite metric of public health impact. So I'll conclude with this slide here, which is that we feel that re-aim, again, which is a framework, not a theory, but can help us understand the characteristics of programs and policies we're starting to apply re-aim to as well, that can reach large numbers of people, be widely adopted, consistently implemented, and produce some replicable and long-lasting effects. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Russ. I guess we see why. Our third speaker is Dr. Charles Glisson from the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. He's a distinguished university professor, speaking about his longstanding work looking at efforts to change organizations alongside with clinical interventions trying to improve practice. So, Charles, please.
Is this one? Yes. That looks good. Great. Thank you, David. Our research has focused many years on the puzzle of why some organizations that provide social and mental health services in community settings seem to be more effective than other organizations. The failure to adopt evidence-based treatment models is one part of that puzzle. But a number of studies, as all of you are well aware, show that the adoption of evidence-based practices is far from sufficient. So I'm going to give you a fast flurry of slides here to give you a quick review of our efforts to understand organizational factors, other organizational factors that may play a role in the implementation of effective services. We begin by assuming that effective community service systems use evidence-based practices, maintain fidelity to practice protocols, develop positive service relationships with consumers, and ensure service availability, responsiveness, continuity. In other words, if we believe that organizations that do all of these things must surely be more effective than others, although we would also admit that the research is not necessarily there to prove that. But we begin with that assumption. Next, our studies are guided by the socio-technical model of organizational effectiveness. The model argues that the implementation of effective services is as much a social process as a technical process. This means that the organization's social context is as important to service effectiveness as its core technology, as the treatment models or the evidence-based practices or the assessment tools and so forth that are used by service providers. So what we do is we argue that successful strategies for implementing new technologies or for improving the effectiveness of existing technologies in actual community organizations must address the social context in which the core technology is embedded. Organizational culture theory is concerned with social context and has been for many, many years, and it argues that organizational culture and climate are key constructs in understanding organization's social context. Culture and climate, you know, have long histories and distinct histories too, and only recently have been mentioned in the same breath. But suffice it to say that organizational culture, as we use the term, defines the norms and the values that define the way things are done in an organization and what is expected of employees. And that's going to be important a little bit later on as I add some more information about culture. Organizational climate describes the psychological impact of the work environment on employees, their affective response to their work environment, and what some people have called the psychological safety they feel in their work environment. Our belief is that a fully developed science of implementation effectiveness must address organizational social context and primarily as defined by culture and climate. And what that requires, you know, is methods for assessing organizational context that we can depend on. We need to identify the dimensions of social context that contribute to effective services, and also we need evidence-based, in quote, organizational interventions that can develop the kinds of social context that support effective implementation. Our objective has been to contribute to the development of knowledge in these three areas, and I want to briefly mention a study in each of these areas. So I'm going to go through this fairly fast just to give you some idea of what we've been doing. The first study uses data from the National Survey of Child and Adolescent Well-Being, or NSCAW as it's called. NSCAW selected a nationwide probability sample of 97 child welfare systems from throughout the country and sampled children that were served by those systems. NSCAW also administered climate scales that we had developed over several years, and that's a part of our organizational social context measure, to caseworkers on site in each of the child welfare systems. In addition, NSCAW collected, I'm not keeping up with myself, in addition, NSCAW collected repeated measures of the psychosocial functioning of children that were served by the agencies. Many of you are familiar with NSCAW, I believe. Just to give you an idea of some of the things we found, a three-level HLM analysis that controlled for the children's demographics, level of maltreatment, location, and a variety of other covariates indicated that the change in psychosocial problems of the children that were served by these child welfare agencies was explained by the organizational climate of these agencies. As shown in this graph produced by the HLM, problems in psychosocial functioning increased for children served by the systems with the worst climates. Problems in psychosocial functioning decreased for children served by systems with the best climates. And these trends resulted in significant clinical differences as well. If we looked at the kids in the very worst climates, we found that they tended to have CBCLT scores that were in the clinical range. If we looked at the kids served by the climate, by the best climates, we found kids with CBCL scores after 3 years that were not in the clinical range. Our next national study was conducted as part of the Clinical Systems Project of the Research Network on Children's Mental Health. We administered our entire organizational social context measure on-site to a nationwide sample of over 1,100 therapists in each of 100 mental health clinics during scheduled staff meetings. The study confirmed our OSC measurement model of social context and established the first national norms for mental health clinics in this area. I want to give you a little information about our OSC scales because they play a central role in some profiles that I'm going to review for you of these clinics in just a minute. Our OSC measurement instrument is completed by direct service providers to measure organizational culture. And we measure organizational culture on three dimensions. Proficient organizational cultures are characterized by the expectation that service providers will be competent, have up-to-date knowledge, and place the well-being of clients first. Rigid cultures are characterized by the expectation that service providers will have little discretion or flexibility and closely follow extensive bureaucratic rules and regulations. Resistant cultures are characterized by the expectation that service providers will show no interest in change or any interest in new ways of providing service. What I want to do is show you several examples of culture profiles based on responses to our scales from the actual clinics in the nationwide sample of mental health clinics. The profiles are based on service provider responses that have been aggregated by clinic, and then we've converted them to T-scores with a mean of 50 and a standard deviation of 10. So let me just run over some of these profiles for you, just to give you some idea of the differences in clinics that we found in our nationwide sample. Here's a clinic that scored right the mean across the board on proficiency, rigidity, and resistance. Another clinic, very high on resistance and lower on proficiency. Yet another, high on proficiency, lower on resistance. Clinics, high rigidity relative to the other scales. Another clinic, lower rigidity relative to the other scales. The reason I'm showing you these were the profiles that emerged most often and that we identified as profile types. And one of the types we identified would be what we would call the worst climate profile type, culture profile type, I'm sorry, in the national sample. Approximately 10% of the clinics had what we would typify or call the worst culture profile. As you can see, it's 1.5 standard deviations below the mean on proficiency and almost 2 standard deviations above the mean on rigidity and resistance. This is one clinic and the 10% of the clinics who had the worst culture profile. Another 10% had the best culture profile. And here you can see one clinic as an example, over 1 standard deviation above the mean on proficiency and very low on rigidity and resistance. Not only did we find that our nationwide sample of clinics had distinctly different culture profiles, but we also found that the profiles were associated with a variety of service-related criteria. Some of these are up on the screen here. The job satisfaction and commitment of the therapist, lower therapist turnover, the sustainability of new treatment programs, and the use of clinical outcome measures characterized clinics with more positive cultures. We've also conducted other studies at our center in which we've linked culture to service quality, staff turnover, work attitudes. So we know that mental health and social service organizations have a variety of culture profiles and also know that the positive profiles are associated with several criteria that appear to be important to implementing effective services. Our OSC survey also measures climate on 3 dimensions as well. We measure climate on engagement, functionality, and stress. Engaged climates are characterized by service providers perceiving that they are able to have a high level of personal accomplishment, involvement, and concern for climate, for clients in their work. Functional climates are characterized by service provider perceptions that they receive the needed cooperation and support to do their jobs. And finally, stressful climates are characterized by service provider perceptions that they are emotionally exhausted and overloaded in their work. We also identified several profiles, climate profiles that typified our sample. Again, here's a clinic that very average values on all three dimensions. Another one very high on stress, very low on engagement. Yeah, another two standard deviations above the mean on engagement, two standard deviations below the mean on stress. High on functionality related to the other two dimensions. Very low on functionality related to the other two dimensions. And similar to culture, we also identified about 10% of the sample that had what we labeled the worst climate profile. You can see here three standard deviations below the mean on engagement and functionality and three standard deviations above the mean on stress. Another 10% were identified that had the best climate profile. This is an example of one clinic from that group, high on engagement and functionality and very low on stress. These climate profiles were also associated with several criteria. We found that the positive climates were associated with therapist job satisfaction, therapist commitment, less difficulty in hiring new therapists, the use of computerized clinical information systems, and the use of productivity measures based that focused on clients, number of clients served rather than the dollars billed. And we've also linked climate to other criteria and other studies that are centered that include work attitudes, service quality, service outcomes. So we know that organizational climate profiles vary among organizations that provide very similar services, and that those profiles are related to several service-related criteria. So we conclude from our studies that organizations differ in social context, that we can measure those differences, and that those differences are associated with service provider attitudes, service provider behaviors, service quality, and service outcomes. So what we now need are evidence-based organizational interventions that can create positive social context, that can improve work attitudes, that can reduce service provider turnover, and support the implementation of evidence-based treatments and other best practices. There are very few organizational intervention studies that have been conducted in mental health and social service organizations, and very few intervention studies that focus on social context use true experimental designs. So we've begun to address these issues in developing and testing what we've labeled our ARC organizational intervention model. ARC stands for availability, responsiveness, and continuity. And ARC is a planned organizational change strategy that's been designed to develop positive social context and engage service providers in removing barriers to effective services. This summarizes the model, and we published it in two or three different articles. You can read about it in more detail. But what this table summarizes, it's comprised of 12 components that are implemented by change agents in three stages and in four phases. And the stages refer to the change and the focus of the change agent's efforts as they move through this process. And the phases refer to the activities of the focal organization. The individual components we selected on the basis of the literature concerning organizational change and their contribution to social context, and adapted them for social service and mental health organizations, and then put them together in a comprehensive model that could be implemented by change agents using a manualized approach. In our experimental test of ARC, we randomly assigned 26 urban and rural case management units to either receive ARC or not receive ARC. And the ones that were assigned to ARC received a one-year ARC intervention. In our experimental test of ARC, climate was significantly improved with the ARC intervention, and turnover was significantly reduced. We were able to create less stressful climates and more engaged climates and reduce turnover by over 40%. Our current and future efforts are aimed at learning more about using our OSC instruments and our ARC organizational intervention in the implementation of evidence-based practices and in the development of a science of implementation effectiveness. Our primary concern is to understand, get a better idea of how we can describe and capture the social context of organizations that are attempting to implement evidence-based practices and the organizational interventions that would be most effective in creating social context that would support the implementation of evidence-based practices.
Thanks, Charles. So I guess cosmically there was some desire for this starting with Denver, ending with Denver. So we think we're straight now. I can see it loading up as we speak. And I'll turn it over to Paul. How's that look?
Thank you. I apologize for the confusion. I particularly apologize to the technical staff. That was completely and totally my fault. I think we got it right this time. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about some of our work in applying principles of complexity science to making change in small primary care practices. And I think it does fit nicely from the comments that Charles made. I mentioned our collaboration. I'm going to review work that has been done from five different centers that makes up our collaborative. I'm going to talk a little bit about the history of the research. I'm not going to talk about results. I'm going to be making a lot of assertions without presenting the evidence. So I'm going to try to pull out the principles that have come out of this work. Then we're going to discuss some of the models that have emerged and how we apply these to current and ongoing work. This represents five studies that have been funded by the NIH over the last 14 years. There are other studies that make up our body of work, but I'm going to focus on these. They tell the story. The direct observation of primary care and the prevention and competing demand studies were funded by NCI and ARC, respectively. Kurt Stange in Ohio conducted the DOPC study, and Ben Crabtree, who was then in Nebraska, conducted the prevention and competing demands. Both were about preventive services in primary care. They were both purely observational studies, and they use multiple methods, everything from extensive chart audits, in over 103 practices across the two studies. We had exit interviews, we had patient surveys, we had staff surveys. We did a lot of direct observation in the prevention and competing demand study. For example, research nurses who were trained in ethnographic methods spent from 2 to 4 weeks in primary care practices. We really made an effort to get under the hood and figure out what makes these things tick. As we began to collect and analyze that data, we began very quickly to publish a lot of papers about pieces of practice. What we felt we were struggling with was some overarching way to conceptualize a primary care practice. We used to say, if you've seen one practice, you've seen one practice. And we studied 103 practices, and we had 103 different ways of thinking about primary care practice. We cast about a bit, and we found that complexity science actually helped us understand and organize our data. Some of the things that we were seeing, practices could not be characterized in mechanistic terms. They simply were not organization as machine. They were nonlinear. Everything we looked at was nonlinear. All the parts and people of a practice are interconnected and interdependent in terms of both their function and their relationships, the way they communicate, the way they trust or not trust each other. Changes in one part of the practice ripple through other parts of the practice in unpredictable ways. Changes don't occur in a linear fashion. Small changes sometimes have large dramatic effects, not always desired effects. And sometimes you would see large changes, or the converse, the other way that I just didn't say it. And very importantly, what works in one practice absolutely doesn't work in another. And there are many different ways that practices can be successful. For example, in these studies, to improve preventive services delivery. Many different ways that they could get to some of the same endpoints. So we found complexity science to be very helpful. And I'm at risk of, I am not a complexity guru, but it might be worthwhile to just jump through a couple of the characteristics of complex adaptive systems. We view complex adaptive systems, or in this case, primary care practices, as groups that consist of agents that have the capacity to learn and the freedom to act in often unpredictable ways. It's useful to think of agents as individuals, but they may also be teams, pieces of technology, organizational processes, or policies. Agents are connected in nonlinear ways. And a nice way that I find to think about that is one agent's actions change the context for all the other agents. And context is all important, as we've heard from two speakers. And the quality of the interactions among agents is more important than the quality of the agents. And that's terribly important in small primary care practices where we find huge differences in education level, socioeconomic level, role in the practice, trust, power, and other things. There are three properties of complex adaptive systems that are worth thinking about. Self-organization is the tendency of many systems to generate new structures and patterns over time as a result of their own internal nonlinear dynamics. And some sort of order emerges from patterns of relationships. This is useful when I think of a primary care practice as sitting in space, and if we want to move it to another space, we can do so with our interventions. I've been involved in hundreds of projects where we can make changes, and then the decay is measured in minutes, not days or weeks. So as soon as you let go, it kind of goes back to some place that makes sense. That's the result of emergence, which is a process by which nonlinear interactions among the agents result in new patterns of behavior. And coevolution is important as well, because the agent co-evolves with the context in which they exist. And the agent in this case can also be the practice. Practices co-evolve with their environment. They don't just adapt to it. The environment changes in response to them. So from this, then we did an intervention study. This study was done by Kurt Stange in Cleveland. It was funded by the National Cancer Institute. And it was 80 practices were randomized into two arms. And we published the intervention that it had an effect, and the effect was sustained for a couple of years. That's all in the literature. I'm not going to deal with that a lot. But it was based on some of the complexity principles. We had facilitators in the practice helping practices improve their interactions among the agents, as well as offering them tools to improve preventive service delivery. What was most interesting about this, about the results of this project, was that while the two arms behave differently in terms of trial endpoints, there were obviously practices in both arms that improved and those that didn't improve. And since we had a ton of mixed method qualitative data, the NCI saw the wisdom in funding us to do a secondary analysis of that data. And again, our five teams took different parts of that. And in many cases, one team would be analyzing data, another team would be auditing what they found. That means, can we find that what you thought was in the data is actually there? Do we find disconfirming evidence and so forth? And from this resulted a model. And before I present that, just in the sense of retaining a bit of humility, we all should, about models, George Box said, all models are wrong, even though some may be useful. This is a model that has been useful to us. It consists of four components, and then in the spirit of complexity science, a lot of interactions. The components are not terribly complicated. We think about the motivation of the key stakeholders in the practice. What are they motivated to do? We think about the capacity of that practice to make change. I'll come back to this in a moment, but it has to do with leadership and the web of relationships and teamwork and a lot of things that we spend a lot of time pulling out of the data, and you would imagine probably without the data that they were present. Also, we think external motivators are important in the opportunities for change. The opportunities for change are things that the stakeholders see on their environment, the guidelines you just sent them, or other things. And then the interactions, when we first came up with, kind of put the model together, we knew the interactions were there because by now we were complexity believers, and so we knew that these were not independent and that they interacted. For example, a very simple thing, an external motivator that might be one of our facilitators working with a practice to improve communication or other things in the practice, then changes the key stakeholder's motivation to take on some change. Now, that's a very linear example, and it doesn't happen linearly. It happens sort of all at once. This is a set of relationships among these components. And the more we work with the model, the more we decide that the interactions are what's important. We can fairly quickly describe a practice in terms of the four boxes. But understanding the relationships requires that we work with them over time. Implications for practice change. Patterns of relationships among staff are critical determinants of practice change. There's a lot going on in that box too, the capacity for change. From high quality interactions, processes will emerge to create high quality change, we hope. Emerging processes will not be the same in every practice. So then we did another trial. This was funded by Heart, Lung, and Blood. It was a 5-year study that's in its 6th year, and so we're still working on the data, but it was specifically designed to test the impact model. We used practice facilitators working with the practice. We had multi-method assessments that were fed back to the practice, so they had some insight about their the way they operated as a complex adaptive system. And we, of course, had endpoints that Heart, Lung, and Blood were interested in. From that work, we have another kind of a view of that capacity to change box. And it's very, very complicated, but we think that there are some parts of it we need to pay attention to. In the center are 7 characteristics of relationships that we think matter. Things like mindfulness, heedful interactions, trust, combination or an appropriate combination of rich and lean communication, respect, a balance of social and task orientation, and cognitive diversity, which exists within hopefully a learning culture in which action and reflection cycles take place. We work with practices on what we call RAP cycles, which is kind of our version of PDSA cycles that really emphasizes reflection and downplays probably the need for data, quantitative data. But nonetheless, take action and reflect on it is critically important. And according to our model, that leads to improvisation and sense-making, teamwork, and based on related to inquiry-centered leadership, this is what we believe the capacity to change within a practice looks like. And we have studies that attempt to measure these. Our current work, our 3 more intervention trials, these are going on now. I'm the director of EPIC, funded by the National Institute of Mental Health, and NIDDK's scope is funded by NCI, as is EPIC's. Kurt and Ben are doing those in Cleveland and New Jersey, respectively. And in these studies, we are systematically varying the intervention. We have facilitation, we have learning sessions, we are feeding back our assessments of the practice. And we're varying the dose and duration of the interventions. Varying the kinds of facilitators and what they focus on. And we are particularly looking at opportunities for small practices to share their experience in a learning session kind of environment, which has been very, very successful. We have the hope that the learning sessions, since they're local practices, may actually live beyond the project. We have yet to demonstrate that, but we are hopeful. So according to the principles of complex adaptive systems, what would a successful practice look like? What are the things we're trying to get practices to move toward? What are we trying to help them with? Well, first of all, it's useful if they can move beyond an organization as machine view of themselves and begin to understand some of what's happening to them in terms of complexity science. And one of those, of course, is to pay more attention to the quality of the interactions among staff, those five little bubbles that were in my last slide. Pay more attention to the quality of the interactions than to the quality of the staff. While in-service training and other forms of knowledge creation is important, it's not as important as the interactions. Another way to say that is to focus on staff learning rather than what staff happens to know today. To encourage cognitive diversity among staff and improvement teams, and to leverage that diversity to foster learning, improvisation, and emergence of new patterns. I tell you, there's nothing more discouraging than being in one of these practices and sitting in on the Tuesday night physician meeting when the physicians are trying to figure out how to improve their practice. And that's just the physicians, who've just spent all of their time in the examining room and frankly don't have a clue how their practice works. So we try to break through that a bit. We want to recognize that the practice is a social entity and foster sense-making, learning, and improvisation. We hope practices will expect and celebrate surprise instead of that, oh man, it didn't work. It's that, wow, why didn't it work and what can we learn from this? And then to begin to understand the interdependence between the formal and informal organizations that exist within a practice, and to get the practice to spend less time trying to conform to their formal organization. So that's the 15-minute rapid tour through small primary care practices as complex adaptive systems. Thank you. Again, I apologize to the technical people for my early error with the slides.
So we actually do have a couple minutes left before we take a break. Are there any, and remember, you do have the cards, and please do write more in-depth questions. But does anyone have any sort of clarifying questions, anything you'd want to ask? It's just, you know, burning to ask any of the three panelists. Yeah, so go to the microphone, great. And I think you can all on the panel press the button and it should activate your mics.
All right, I had this one written down and I'm still gonna go ahead and ask it. When you're talking about these social psychological factors, the two most recent speakers, I'm wondering how you sort of deal with that in the REAIM framework when you sort of said, we wanna try to minimize volitional. That's the question.
We may need to talk. I didn't recall saying I wanted to minimize volitional. I think what I was talking about on some of that was related maybe to the issue, we may need to talk more at break, but about, if you will, the balance between fidelity to a program and appropriate adaptation. I think what I was trying to focus on there. And to me, the notion of where this relates to the theory is that rather than expecting kind of, say, delivery of 100 different procedural details as they were in an original protocol that you, whatever, we might talk about the theories underlying them or the essential components. And how those things are delivered. And I guess I see those, that's where maybe some of the flexibility comes in across those issues, and that it's not always one particular example or procedure, but it's more a process that we focus on or a mechanism that's addressed.
Thanks, Russ. One more question. Yeah.
Hi. Thank you for organizing this. This wonderful conference so far, and I'm sure it's going to get even better. Dr. Abrams spoke about how successful we have been in terms of the general public and getting them to have behavioral health changes, and then most of the rest of you have talked about how incredibly difficult it is to get clinicians to change. And so my conclusion is that professional school is dangerous for your flexibility. And I'm wondering whether maybe the solution would be if we could eliminate professional schools. That's a joke, but I think there's a core of something in that about what happens in professional socialization.
It's probably a provocative way to lead directly into the break where everyone can join in on that conversation. So we're going to reconvene at 10:45. Thanks for your patience, and we'll see you.
So we're going to move on now to our next panel, and I'm going to introduce Tom Hilton, who is the moderator for this panel.
Thank you, Dara. Well, we've been exposed to some really neat theories and ideas about implementation, dissemination. Now we're going to move on a little bit to how do you study this stuff. And as we've already seen earlier this morning, things are pretty complex out there. They even have a complexity theory to go along with it, which we heard. And now I think we're going to try to get a little bit more concrete about what we're talking about here. Our first speaker, Brian Mittman, certainly is peerless in his understanding of implementation. He co-edits an online journal called Implementation Science, which was mentioned in the earlier part of the meeting this morning. And I'm just going to, since there are biographical sketches in the back, I'm going to skip going on to talking about people's background. They're all great. I do want to remind you that if you have questions, write them down on the little cards, and there's little boxes for each of the different presentations that you can put them in there, and we will address those during the breakout sessions this afternoon. So without further delay, I'm going to introduce Dr. Brian Mittman.
Thank you. I, too, would like to thank the organizers for the invitation and opportunity to participate in the meeting, and also to acknowledge the attendance and interest, the attendance both here as well as through the Internet. To me, it's a partial validation of some decisions I've made in the past to devote time to some initiatives that are designed to strengthen the field and within VA and outside, as opposed to doing some of my own research in this area. But it's also gratifying relative to my role as co-editor of the journal Implementation Science in terms of our expectations for future readership growth and submissions as well. My talk reflects the ideas and efforts of a fair amount of trial and error learning and researchers within VA's Health Services Research and Development Service, as well as many discussions with colleagues within the field through the journal, through some of VA's collaborations with NIH, ARC, RWJ, CDC, Commonwealth Fund, and so on. For the most part, the content of my talk will focus on material that's been developed by VA. I'll conclude with some comments at the end, though, that reflect some more personal views and assessments of the field. Outlined briefly, I'll spend just a very few minutes providing a brief overview of the query. The bulk of my comments will be a brief presentation of a number of query's key frameworks. The presentation, as with some of the past, will consist of a series of sound bites. There's no time to go into any detail. But I will attempt to, I suppose, advertise the existence of the frameworks, encourage you to seek out additional information. And then, as I said, some more personal comments in my own view of what the broader challenge is to the field and where I believe we need to make more progress and begin to move in some slightly different directions. This slide summarizes or lists Query's mission. Query, I believe, is an excellent example of what Larry Green has labeled practice-based evidence. Query is a hybrid research and quality improvement program within VA. I think Query's mission is best described or explained by the 51% rule. That rule states that at least 51% of Query funding and project activity should be devoted to direct improvements in patient care and performance and outcomes. That leaves no more than 49% for research and evaluation. It has been, as you can imagine, for a program that is conducted by researchers, it has been an ongoing struggle to try to encourage the researchers to balance their efforts and to simultaneously attend to their practice and quality improvement goals as well as their research goals. But I would assert that many of our contributions, both to improvement within VA as well as to the field of implementation science, can be traced directly back to that tension and the need for the researchers to simultaneously juggle and balance both sets of goals. This is just a map that shows the query centers. There are, on this complicated map, 9 disease-specific query centers throughout the United States. Most of them are co-located with VA's Health Services Research and Development Service centers. The query centers do have a disease focus, although they are for the most part centers without walls. The headquarters are based at these facilities, but the query researchers are based throughout the VA, and they coordinate largely via email, telephone, and so on. The four query frameworks that I will present briefly basically fall into two categories. The first set of three frameworks address the question, what is implementation research? What is the appropriate mix and sequencing of research projects that would comprise a program of implementation research? The second framework addresses the question, what is the optimal set of aims, designs, and components of an implementation study? And again, I'll describe these very briefly without going into as much detail as I would like. This slide lists some of the sources for the frameworks that Query has developed and evolved over the years to guide our implementation research. And I would say that the existence of these frameworks and sources has been a mixed bag. On the one hand, it has offered Query researchers some guidance in answering the key questions. What is the appropriate mix and sequencing and timing of research projects? What are the appropriate designs and methods and so on? On the other hand, though, given that for the most part these come out of a clinical research tradition, the kind of language, the mindset, and the orientation that much of our projects have adopted or had adopted in the early years were, I think, too closely aligned with some of the clinical research approaches and some research approaches that perhaps aren't fully suited, well-suited to implementation science, and I'll come back to that in my last slide. The first framework that Query uses is an adaptation of many of the pipeline models that exist. Most of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the Institute of Medicine Clinical Research Roundtable pipeline, and I won't go into this in detail. I will, however, display a simplified version. And that is the idea that we see two translational roadblocks, or voltage drops, I believe is the other term that's often used. Translation one, where we see basic and lab research findings insufficiently taken up by the clinical researchers and translated into effective clinical practices. And of course, translation two, the second roadblock that is of interest to us, the lack of uptake of clinical research findings and output into improved practices and health outcomes. This is a more detailed version of a health-related pipeline that guides much of VA's work, and again, it shows the first translational phase from basic science into clinical research, and then the second from clinical research into implementation. What it also shows, though, and I think what is important for a Query as well as other implementation researchers, is to recognize that the kinds of evidence-based practices that we take as inputs into our implementation research efforts come not only from clinical research, but also from health behavior, health promotion research, as well as health services research. In fact, one of the areas of controversy and where further development is needed in the field, I believe, is in the distinction between the focus of implementation research and what constitutes an implementation intervention or implementation program versus what constitutes a clinical program or a best practice. One example is case management. Case management can be viewed as an implementation strategy. It's a way of encouraging better adherence to evidence-based clinical practice guidelines. And as such, the evaluation of case management as an implementation strategy would involve assessment of improvements in clinical practices and adherence to guidelines. On the other hand, case management can also be viewed as a clinical program with direct impacts on patient outcomes. And as such, the appropriate evaluation of case management would involve studying and evaluating or measuring clinical outcomes. In the journal Implementation Science, we've actually struggled with some articles and the way in which they are framed and written as to whether they do represent implementation research or not. So even an area that seems to be relatively simple and well thought out, where there is good guidance, in fact, as we begin to look more closely at some of the studies that are conducted and the ways in which those studies are designed and the outcomes that are measured, we see that there's some confusion and some need for further elaboration, further development of many of these frameworks. Let me move then to the second framework. And this slide depicts the query six-step process, what we often refer to as the Query Ten Commandments. This list of six steps was developed in the late 1990s when Query was first established. And it was developed to guide the query centers in identifying the kinds of research and, again, the sequencing and timing of their research as part of a practice-targeted, research-based quality improvement program. although we recognize the danger in modifying the Ten Commandments, we also, in the early years of query, realized that many of the kinds of research activities that are necessary for query centers were not captured by the six steps, so there were two steps that were added. And these represent two additional categories of work that need to be included in a program of implementation research. And actually, in the case of Step C, it's considered pre-query. This is the kind of research that falls into the three gold-colored pipelines on my previous slide: research to develop the best practices, the effective evidence-based clinical practices that are then implemented by query. This slide depicts these six or the eight steps relative to the pipeline, and again shows that steps 1, C, 2, and M are essentially pre-implementation. Step 3 is between pre-implementation and implementation, and then steps 4, 5, and 6 constitute the core of implementation research activity. This slide has been useful in terms of helping query centers to identify the kinds of research that need to be conducted, and also to assess whether or not some of the preliminary research has been completed. So some of the previous speakers have talked about the danger of jumping immediately into a large-scale trial. Jeremy Grimshaw mentioned this in reference to the MRC four-phase scheme for implementation research. A query center that is interested in implementing evidence-based practices and conducting step 4, 5, 6 work, the implementation projects, needs to first assess the existence of appropriate output from step 3 work, step M, and the other work. So the goal of this and purpose of this framework is, again, as an organizing framework to ensure that the research that is conducted is done so in a logical manner without skipping steps. Again, after a number of years of working with the query steps, we realized that those steps were incomplete. The annotated query six-step process emerged within the last few years to allow us to understand the specific details of each individual step. In the case of query step 3, it's not sufficient to simply define the existing practices and identify practice gaps and jump immediately to the treatment, the implementation of interventions to improve practice. Instead, there's a need to first diagnose and understand current practices, to assess barriers, facilitators, and so on. This is just one example of one of the annotated query steps. There are others for all eight of the query steps that, again, attempt to provide this level of detailed guidance and some assistance, we hope, in ensuring that steps are not skipped and that work is done in a more logical progression. The third framework that I will present is depicted in the lower right-hand corner. This is actually an adaptation of the Medical Research Council four-phase framework that Jeremy Grimshaw mentioned. The individual phases are listed here. There's actually a number of differences between our version of the four-phase model and the MRC, and there are, of course, other four-phase, five-phase, six-phase schemes as well. Some of the unique features of ours involve, first of all, the fact that we're working in a large healthcare delivery system, and we have the ability to begin with small pilots working with one or two medical centers, to progress to larger trials that may involve a half a dozen to eight centers, and conduct those trials in a way that, and those are phase two studies, that do entail a great deal of research, technical assistance and support, and essentially represent an efficacy study. Under the best case scenario, can these programs be effective? We then move into a phase three study, which is more of an effectiveness study of an implementation program, where the responsibility for the implementation program is turned over to practice units and groups, policy groups within VA. So it's a larger scale, rigorous trial under more routine conditions. And of course, a phase four post-marketing type monitoring study. So again, many similarities, and based on the UK's four-phase and other four-phase, five-phase, six-phase schemes, but one that we feel matches both the VA as well as non-VA settings, and in particular implementation research, in a more useful manner. The final framework that I will touch on very briefly before concluding is what we label the service-directed project template. VA has a number of funding mechanisms for our implementation research. The projects that meet the 51% rule, that have as their primary focus implementing evidence-based practices and improving quality, are funded through our service-directed program. What we found in the early years of query was that the projects that we were receiving, the proposals, resembled clinical trials to an extent that was inappropriate, that there were many features of implementation research that were not fully understood and incorporated in these trials. And what we felt was needed was some better guidance to the implementation scientists as far as a template, which is basically a consort-like statement that is designed to guide the design, the conduct, and the reporting of implementation studies. as with the other frameworks, I don't have time to go through this in detail. But I'll just hit some of the highlights. Under the specific aims, we feel it's important for an implementation study to begin with a set of aims that both address the implementation or quality improvement goals as well as the science goals, that these projects do need to address both sets of goals simultaneously and both need to be specified explicitly. We need to see hypotheses that address not only the impacts or the outcomes of the improvement programs or the implementation strategies, but also details of the processes or the causal mechanisms within those processes. In the case of previous studies in the grant application, some assessment or review of current practices and their determinants and barriers and facilitators to change, and if previous studies have not been completed, to provide that information. That kind of work needs to be included in the project, as well as a review of the implementation strategy and the existing theory and empirical evidence that supports it. We saw and continue to see far too many grant applications coming into this area, which don't take sufficient account of what's been done in the past, and use that work not only to refine the current strategy or the hypothesized and evaluated program, but in some cases to lead the researchers to realize that the study is not needed, that we have sufficient evidence, and that other work is perhaps of higher priority. In the case of design and methods, there are a number of items on the checklist, essentially, for the intervention, the need to address the legitimacy of the evidence that is to be implemented, and a number of factors that are critical to the effectiveness of an intervention or a quality improvement program or strategy, and yet are often not attended to by the researchers. So with apologies for going through these quickly and not listing them, again, my goal here, I think, is to give a bit of a flavor as to what these frameworks entail and contain, and encourage you to watch for the publications and seek additional information. Some highlights in this one set of features of the template under evaluation details. Randomization protocol, for example, is one of many areas where the usual rules that we apply in clinical trials of drug treatments and interventions, medical interventions, perhaps don't apply. In the case of randomization and in the case of sampling, one of the rules of thumb within query is that in order to develop the most representative sample possible, it's actually important not to sample in a random manner, but instead to use purposeful sampling. If our goal is to recruit a set of sites that best represent the sites and the circumstances and conditions that will exist in the future when the time comes to implement a program nationally, we have to recognize that at the current time, the field's assessment of the quality improvement program that we are evaluating is not positive. And so what we need to do is what's sometimes referred to as cherry picking, to identify those sites that do have more of a belief in the efficacy of the program and are more willing to provide the kind of internal support for that intervention in order to provide the contextual factors. So the idea, though, is that a simple direct application of rules of thumb and principles from clinical studies to implementation is often misleading and wrong, and this is just one of many examples. Let me conclude then with a few comments in answer to the questions that I've laid out on this slide. And again, there are many, many areas of further development that are needed in this field. To me, perhaps the most important and the most challenging is captured by this set of questions. The first, what is the nature of the desired evidence, the knowledge, understanding, and more importantly, the desired learning and skills that we need to generate? If in fact, the answer is that the desired evidence and knowledge is somewhat different from what health research typically generates, how do we produce that knowledge? Is our current portfolio producing this knowledge? Must we rebalance it, and if so, how? Starting from the bottom, my answer would be yes, we do need to rebalance the portfolio because I don't believe it's producing this understanding. I hope that we'll have time during the afternoon to discuss this in far more detail, but I think if we take Paul Nutting's talk and put that next to Jeremy Grimshaw's talk and begin to think a little bit about the implications of some of the complex adaptive systems theory, we begin to realize that the extent to which we can apply traditional clinical research approaches to this field and develop insights may be limited. The idea of evidence assumes that evidence is a property of an implementation strategy or program, and the idea of a trial of that program assumes that the main effect is large enough to be detectable within a reasonable sample size. Let's suppose that the main effect of any intervention or implementation strategy is on the order of 1 or 2%. and that the remainder of the effect is based on a very large number of contextual factors or effect modifiers. If that's the case, we don't have the statistics, or actually more accurately, we don't have the sample size that will allow us to detect that effect. There is an argument to be made, and I read that argument from Paul Nutting's comments, that it doesn't much matter which intervention program is employed, that all of the contextual factors and the way in which that program is employed are far more important. I don't believe that our current research approach allows us to generate the kinds of insights and knowledge that is needed. And the traditional concept of evidence is of relatively limited value. There are some people, some authors and observers who have been thinking about this and writing about it. The concepts of tacit knowledge, experiential learning, and so on. Don Berwick, Paul Batalden have been at the forefront, Frank Davidoff as well. So again, given time limitations, there isn't time to more fully explore this, but the basic argument is that we do need to think about a different kind of information, a different kind of insight, and a different type of research activity that will generate the kinds of information understanding that we need. And the challenge to the field, as I see it, is for us to begin to think through this, to look to our colleagues in artificial intelligence and other fields, and to see if we can collectively rebalance our portfolio and develop a program of research that I think is more likely to generate the needed insights. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Dr. John Morgenstern, and he's going to, start with where randomized clinical trials end.
Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be here. Is that the pointer? Is this the pointer? Okay, I want to just start with an overview of my talk. These are very brief presentations, so really going to try to give you highlights of things we've been doing over the last 10 years. The problem we all confront is that treatments that have been demonstrated effective in laboratory settings are not routinely adopted in practice. What I believe is that models are very critical to guide dissemination efforts. I think everything we've heard today speaks to that. The stage model has been used widely to guide dissemination in the drug abuse field over the last 10 or 15 years, but it's shown some limitations in behavioral treatment research. I want to review those and then talk a little bit about a model that's drawn from outside the biomedical science field that offers a promising alternative. If I have time, I want to talk a little bit about the fact that no model is perfect and that ultimately we have to strive for methodological innovations that balance scientific rigor against policy relevance. So just to get started, everybody is familiar with the stage model. It's guides NIH research. Stage one is a proof of concept, a safety feasibility, pilot evidence. If those criteria are satisfied, we move on then to an efficacy control trial. Assuming we have an intervention that works in laboratory settings, in stage three, we move into practice settings. The typical differences there are instead of contrasting the intervention with a placebo, we're now contrasting it with treatment as usual, and we're using our community providers to deliver it, assuming then that we are able to demonstrate effectiveness for that intervention, we move to adoption to the wider system. A couple of features of this that are important are it's basically a top-down model. It's very much science-driven from the top without a lot of bottom or context or provider input. And the other thing is it's sequential. It really moves. You don't move from one stage until the other until you've satisfied the criteria of the prior stage. This has been an incredibly productive model. It's guided biomedical research. The National Institutes of Health have set up clinical trials networks to do this. The Cancer Clinical Trials Network is perhaps the best paradigm. And it was a paradigm that was used in the drug abuse field to create the Clinical Trials Network at NIDA. And this Clinical Trials Network and the approach has been used, as I say, for the past 10 or 15 years to tremendous effect. And I'm sorry I don't have time to reel off all the wonderful things that the work that's been done in this area, but Dennis McCarty later will. Unfortunately, we've also identified some problems with this model that some of which were unexpected. And this slide just gives you a sense of interventions that we have that were proved effective in stage two. I won't go through these, motivational interviewing, cognitive behavioral therapy are just some examples. And what we've really been able over the past 10 or 15 years to validate in an effectiveness trial. And unfortunately, there aren't many of them. Vouchers and methadone programs is essentially the one that's really survived with substantial effects. Motivational interviewing, behavioral couples therapy have some modest findings, and there's really a question about whether certainly more studies are going to need to be done. Two things about this. Number one, the studies that have been done have not had robust findings. Number two, it's taken an awful long time to get this pipeline going. Why would there be the issue of lack of robust findings in these effectiveness studies? We expect some of that whenever you move from laboratory to field settings, but here, things seem to be more than we expected. There are a lot of theories about this. One is these are very complex psychotherapy interventions being delivered by frontline staff. Another one is that there are very powerful social system influences among drug abusers that are not introduced in the laboratory, taking people out who are criminal justice or homeless. And then we reintroduce these things in stage three, and lo and behold, we find these are complex. And then there may be greater overlap in the active ingredients in our behavioral interventions with our evidence-based practice. Another issue is that there are formidable hurdles going from stage three to stage four. And unfortunately, as of this point, we really in the drug abuse field don't have any particular evidence-based intervention that we've been able to move into stage four. That may be really expected. It perhaps is premature to think that we would at this point, but I think overall the feeling is that progress has been slow. We've also found many hurdles that really concern us. And here are just a couple of them. We have very weak organizational capacity of providers in the drug abuse field. A lot of study has been done on this. Tom McClellan's writing is particularly apropos. The turnover in counselors in facilities is tremendous. And our teaching models where we try to take manualized interventions and supervise and teach clinicians, which is very much provider individual, provider oriented, are difficult to mount when you have, you know, the staff in 3 years, no single staff member is still left who was there 3 years ago. There's also limited interest in top-down innovation from the provider field and from stakeholders. The modest effects of evidence-based practices raise a relative benefit question. When I go out and talk to large system chiefs, they say, well, if you can only get this much in an effectiveness trial, does it really pay for me to retrain my entire staff and the cost just to get that minimal benefit? There's no funding for sustainability out in the field. And in some sense, the entire system fails to account for drivers of system change. So the question is there any other model that might work better? And I think the answer is perhaps. And the model that I want to talk about primarily today is a policy-relevant experimental field trial. This is an approach that has been used in other social service areas, primarily in welfare, and there have been literally hundreds of random assignment studies in the welfare field done on social interventions that have been demonstrated either to be effective or ineffective, and those changes have been widely adopted in the welfare field. And this is something I really found out about by accident, having gotten in the welfare field sort of inadvertently. So I want to just take you through this very quickly. I want to talk a little bit about the model itself. We have four funded studies that we're currently doing now. I want to give you an example of something that was very successful in terms of moving from evidence to adoption in the space of 10 years. The first step is this begins with a policy event. The policy event I define as a government agency looking to take action on an important service system problem. Often these involve critical policy issues, dual disorders, housing problems, and there is a proposed system change that has occurred. I'll give you some examples of these that we're currently looking at. Welfare reform made huge changes in the social and health care services. We're looking at that in New York and New Jersey. A huge funding for supportive housing for drug abusers, a new program that's worth about $750 million in New York. A managed care pilot that we're doing in collaboration with OASIS. Now, these are all service system events. These are not studies. What happens, though, is the service system event, if it can be turned into an experiment, you're able to capitalize on a naturally occurring change event. that's a driver of system change and try to turn it into an experiment and to try to use this as an alternative to test what's being proposed as something new and promising against what has existed. Step two is a planning process. Obviously, these things do not turn into experiments until there's a planning process. And the planning process really involves a very a period of intense discussions and bi-directional talks between researchers and government stakeholders. And I contrast this to the stage model where essentially the planning process is typically done either among scientists themselves or providers. And in the case of drug abuse, the providers really are relatively weak organizationally. Funders are also involved. The process also involves an interesting mix of things. It's very much top-down. It's very much bottom-up, top-down. First, it begins with a system analysis of what is the problem and what the system can handle. Next, you then look at what are the promising practices. And this is an issue of both not just evidence-based manuals, but potentially evidence-based principles. So if we know that contingency management works, we can say, well, maybe rewarding people for good behavior is a good idea and take that beyond simply the manual that we have that's limited in its application. There are strong designs. Sustainability is built in from the get-go because, remember, the government stakeholders are interested in creating something that, if it works, can be brought to scale quickly and affordably. And finally, there's the issue of policy relevance. There's a lot of discussions about alternative in designs. We have them as scientists. It's very interesting to partner with government agencies because there are a lot of questions that you could ask, but ultimately the government needs to know of two alternatives, which one is going to be the best that's relevant to our questions and our concerns. Next, we move to a field trial. The field trial is a typical field trial. The government is contracts with the providers. Research team provides technical assistance, but is not in the driver's seat here. And the focus is on the key features that typically involve random assignment, the experimental treatment versus what's typically happening in the system. There's a huge focus on implementations, outcomes, and particularly costs. And finally, adoption happens relatively in a different way, and some of the obstacles that you see in stage four in the stage model are overcome. There's immediate stakeholder buy-in because the state is the driver and has its interests. There are contracted services that are available to sustain funding. There are model programs available to do this, and there's a huge amount of decision support, including information about costs and relative efficacy. So just very quickly, this is the New Jersey Substance Abuse Demonstration Project. This has been going on for 10 years. I want to briefly just go through this with you in 3 minutes. It began with the Welfare Reform Act in 1996. The New Jersey Department of Human Services had an issue. How do you get drug-abusing mothers to enter welfare-to-work programs and get jobs? A planning process was implemented for 2 years involving a state and county agencies, both welfare and substance abuse treatment. I was at Rutgers University at the time and worked with my colleagues there. We eventually got funding from ACF and NIDA to do this work. The work involved an examination of the welfare and treatment service systems and how to coordinate them. We used a bunch of evidence-based practices and model programs, including screening and referral, motivational interviewing, vouchers, work programs, et cetera. We used an experimental design focused on sustainability and built in a big piece on cost-benefit analysis. This was the trial itself. This is an incredibly simplistic detail. It took 5 years. We essentially screened welfare recipients coming in. They were identified as being drug dependent and either were assigned to a referral to a substance abuse treatment program with some minimal welfare care coordination or to intensive case management. The welfare, this was a very minimal, inexpensive, this was a more robust, intensive, and more expensive intervention. This just gives you very briefly the findings that we had at 24 months. And literally, we were able to double the rates of abstinence in the intensive case management intervention. And at month 24, we were able to more than double the employment rate. So these are not only statistically significant, but robust and meaningful findings. I don't think we're going to achieve this at every point in every experimental field trial, but I think the features of this field trial are such that they allowed us to, through a systems analysis and good application and implementation, figure out where the problems were in the service system and apply our science to those problems rather than using a top-down model. Finally, the adoption piece of this. As of 2002, the state began to expand the program within the demonstration counties. By 2004, it had expanded it to 4 additional counties, and today the program operates in 19 counties. So not only did we get a strong experimental finding, the state took those findings and said, we really like this. I had a lot of stakeholder buy-in from the state agencies that do the funding. The providers were interested and already engaged. And within the space of 10 years, we were able to move from a problem to adoption. So finally, let me just summarize very briefly. The stage model with its top-down sequential features has been the dominant paradigm, at least in the drug abuse field. I think we're all in agreement that we need to expand that. Policy-relevant field trials offer a promising alternative strategy, certainly not the only one. I think better understanding of policy events as system-level teachable moments is something that I would come out of this, that like we think about individuals and how we change individuals, well, we got to find an individual at a point where they're ready to change and there's some teachable moment. I think that we need to think about systems in the same way, and policy events really have that kind of dynamic and maybe more worthwhile studying. And certainly, as Brian said, I think we're going to need new methods that balance rigor and policy relevance. And Brian mentioned a number of people, including Berwick, who is thinking about things in a very different way that's very exciting. And I'll stop there.
All right, our final speaker is Greg Ahrens from San Diego, and he is going to talk a little bit more about what Charles Lisson introduced this morning, and that is the role of organizational factors in implementation science.
Okay, so thank you, Tom. I am going to talk about measuring organizational readiness, and the interesting thing about this is that when you talk about organizational readiness, organizations are populated by people. So you have organizational levels, they work within the organization, people work within systems, and organizations have relationships with systems. So there's a lot to think about when we talk about organizational readiness. And my goal today is really to facilitate thinking about theories, measures that may be applied in dissemination and implementation studies. And we've talked a little bit about the definitions of dissemination and implementation, but I think it also includes, you know, diffusion, adoption decisions, and sustainability has been brought up by many of the speakers today. So what is readiness? The state or quality of being ready, preparation, aptitude, willingness. Some organizations appear to have higher levels of readiness than others, or may have cultures and climates supportive of adaptation and change. Many organizations where I do most of my work, which is in public sector, mental health, and social services, are contracted agencies. So they get ready when RFPs come out to provide services of a certain type. Services that have implications in terms of their funding and ongoing funding and monitoring of what they do and meeting contract obligations. But I think it's important to consider, you know, the structures, people, processes, the technology, the type of intervention or evidence-based practice, how it serves consumers, if there's a choice or preference at the consumer level that might impact what clinicians and organizations are doing. And milieus of business practice, advocacy, and funding that all can impact an organization's stance towards uptake. So how do we measure ready for change? Well, it's a big question, and what I want to do is talk about some issues first, throw up some kind of complicated pictures with boxes and arrows, just to give an idea of some of the constructs that can be measured. Talk about some work that we've been doing in terms of assessing organizational readiness to change and developing a measure. And just prior to that, we'll talk about some existing measures that are out there and available. One of the main things, as I mentioned, multiple systems and levels within systems need to be considered. So in terms of system readiness, do policies support EBP readiness? Is there collaboration between agencies? Are those agencies and organizations used to collaborating? Are they mavericks? Would they rather be cowboys and do things on their own? Is there competitiveness? And what's going to be required in terms of a system change? And I think Dr. Morgenstern's talk really highlights this, that when we think of the broader context of organizational change within systems, then things get more complex. In terms of the organization, there's different ways to think about what's going on within the organization. For example, thinking about an organization's willingness to take risk. And Phil Spinzano, who's here today, has done some work in that area. Damanpour in 91 did a nice meta-analysis of adoption of innovation and issues related to that. Looked at things like the organization type, adoption stage, the type and scope of the innovation, whether it's going to be more encompassing or a targeted intervention that's not going to affect the broader organizational functioning. You need to also consider the individual, the impact of individual characteristics, demographics, education, level of professional training, personality, openness to trying new things, and some work that I've done in looking at provider openness suggests that that may be important when implementing new practices. And then the interactions of all of these elements in implementing change. This is a model that I like to use that has to do with the organizational adoption decision by Frombeck and Schillewort. And this one talks about what are the elements that come into play when an organization considers adopting. So this is a two-phase model in which there's things leading up to the adoption decision and then individual adoption at the provider level. And I think this is a useful heuristic, although as we were warned earlier today in our keynote talk, that many of these models are heuristic, and these are opportunities for research on how these things really impact adoption decisions. And then in terms of once the adoption decision is made, what are the factors that might influence how well an intervention is developed? This is a model that I adapted from Frombeck and Schillewort, where we have all these different areas for measurement and different things that can impact or are believed to impact adoption at the individual provider level. Things within the organization, training, leadership, the culture and climate of the organization, the social networks of providers, personal characteristics of providers, as I mentioned, attitudes towards adopting evidence-based practices or innovation in general, someone's personal adaptability, whether they're willing to take on, whether they like trying new things, and then from the social science literature, behavioral intention and self-efficacy should lead to individual acceptance. And in a statewide implementation study that I have ongoing now, we're looking at these factors. So in terms of organizational factors, looking at the social context, the culture and climate of these organizations, and their impact on provider attitudes towards evidence-based practice, whether or not the organizational factors such as a positive work climate or burnout and emotional exhaustion impacts the working alliance between a clinician and a client. When we're thinking about implementation studies, we can take different parts of the process. I think this is all fair ground for designing studies and thinking about what we want to research. What happens when you adopt in a top-down way in terms of the workforce? Does it decrease or increase perceived job autonomy, work attitudes such as job satisfaction and organizational commitment, and does that lead to increased staff turnover, which is a real major problem in many service settings? And then in terms of organizational process, how do these things all interact together? So it's important to have good measures of these constructs. And fortunately, there are some, and there are some being developed. Charles Glisson earlier talked about the ARC model and the considerable work that he's done over the years in terms of the socio-technical model and measuring those aspects of services. I'm using some of those measures in the statewide study. There's a group at Texas Christian University, Simpson and Flynn and Lehman, who have been working in the substance abuse treatment area, developing a model of organizational readiness for change with some measures that go along with that, that assess some very similar constructs to what other folks are doing, but also some unique constructs unique to the substance abuse treatment areas. And they're also looking at and have developed a survey of organizational functioning that ties into that. In terms of more approaches, the Levesque-Prochaska, which is the trans-theoretical model, which was developed from really from clinical intervention, motivational enhancement, and motivational interviewing. It appears that we know now that the translation to an organizational level is not so clear-cut, that it may be having some real problems. And when I talk to people about implementation and doing implementation studies, I really encourage people to look across literatures and across levels and in terms of thinking about how we can come up with innovative and creative studies and models of implementation. So typically I look into the business literature, organizational management literatures. Holt and Armenicus have reviewed 32 organizational readiness for change instruments, and they're also developing their own. So while they reviewed 32 of those, apparently there's still room for more. Look to the work of Steve Shortell and Ewan Furley in terms of thinking about theoretical model for quality improvement in medical care, but also I think that that multi-level across systems, organizations, and people can be really useful in terms of thinking about where you want to measure in your implementation model. So if you have an implementation intervention that's focused on the organizational culture and climate, your measurement will likely be much heavier there than perhaps individual provider characteristics or consumer level. And then Hayes in 2005 had a review of implementation readiness issues and concerns, categorized these into the areas of leadership, the stance towards change, the culture, staffing, and technical readiness. So those are all kind of distinct areas that Hayes identified in terms of looking at. In terms of measurement at the provider level, some of the work that I've done is the evidence-based practice attitude scale, looking at factors such as the intuitive appeal of an intervention, willingness to adopt given requirements, and the perceived divergence between the practice that an individual is doing and usual care, something Klein and Sora talk about called values innovation fit that can also be assessed. I have a study that we're actually just wrapping up, concept mapping of readiness for evidence-based practice, in which we engage multiple stakeholders, policy, agency, program, clinician, administration, and consumer levels to brainstorm with them about what are the factors that would either inhibit or facilitate implementation of evidence-based practice. We did an intense focus group with different stakeholders, segregated by groups, so people were free to speak their opinions. Supervisors weren't with clinicians, for example, and did item generation, sorting, and rating tasks using multidimensional scaling and cluster analysis, identified these 14 domains that kind of span a bit of what I've been talking about in terms of system readiness and compatibility at the organization level, down to consumer concerns and consumer values, so marketing interventions to consumers, so that might have impact for social marketing type interventions. And then through a collaboration with Enola Proctor's Advanced Center, the Center for Mental Health Services Research at Washington University, we're working through a pilot study to do additional identification of domains of organizational receptivity. And we used a lot of the same stakeholder levels, but in this case did very in-depth interviews addressing from levels of executive management and policy at the governmental level down through agency executive directors, clinicians, and staff. What are the factors that might inhibit or facilitate implementation? And we're doing qualitative analysis and combining those data with the results of the concept mapping And we have identified 22 domains through 6 major content areas. And the content areas are the organizational level characteristics, individual characteristics, resources and funding, knowledge, communication, large-scale implementation and buy-in, those types of things under knowledge, consumer factors, marketing and outreach, fit with consumers, and outcomes that are amenable to consumers' perspectives, and then specific elements of innovation or EBP characteristics, whether it can be adapted or whether it needs to be delivered. In my experience, adaptation occurs despite efforts to maintain the model. The question is how much adaptation can be allowed or is acceptable to maintain enough model fidelity to get the effects that you need. So we're currently in the item development phase, developing 5 to 6 items for each domain subcategory, and then we'll be doing examinations for face and content validity of those. Here's some examples for a leadership domain that emerged. We have versions for different levels, organizational levels at the staff, supervisor, and administrative levels. For funding questions, we may go just to the folks who really know about the funding decisions. This is just a grid of where we're going with the domains and what we're working on. Within each of those domains, we're developing items to be tested. And then once it's completed, as I said, we'll examine for face and content validity and then do further psychometric analyses. One thing I just want to say before I finish up is that it's important to do your own qualitative assessment. And I think John Morgenstern's talk highlights that when you're out meeting with organizations or meeting with policymakers or government agencies and folks, when I'm having those conversations, I'm always doing an internal assessment of how collaborative, how open, what resources will be made available, how much of a push there can be in terms of doing these types of studies, where on Roger's dimension of innovation do people fall, and how might that impact the likely success or failure of a research project and implementation. So it's kind of a gut check about moving this forward. And so there's a lot of people interaction in doing implementation research that I think is different, much different from the more top-down RCT approach. But I still think that there's reason for optimism about assessing readiness. There are existing measures. Our group is not the only group doing work on developing or refining measures of organizational readiness. There's no single best model, I think, in terms of funding and innovative applications. There are a number of literatures out there that can serve you well in terms of thinking about theoretical models to guide your implementation study. But I'm hoping that our contribution will be a useful tool to measure implementation readiness in public sector settings. Thank you.
I think we have time for one quick question. If somebody has something that's absolutely burning they want to bring up now before the break. Go up to the microphones, please.
Hi, I had a question about the field experiment model. How do you deal with IRBs? Did you have to go through IRB for all those people in the state that were undergoing the policy change? I mean, how do you, if you're an academic overseeing the project, how do you interface with an IRB and some of these innovative models?
Yeah, that's a very good question. It depends on the particular setting and circumstance that you're dealing with. Welfare demonstration projects are exempt from IRB requirements. And the way we've done things typically is as the research entity, we have tried to avoid being the entity that does the randomization. So typically the state agency is the entity that does the randomization. So to some extent that's helpful, but it's a complicated issue about human subjects.
Let me just comment as well. In implementation studies, depending on your study, the subject may be the provider rather than the patient. And in that case, IRB can be less of a problem, although I've had, you know, IRB committees really be concerned, as well as reviewers, NIH reviewers. And then in terms of outcomes, if you're working closely with an agency or a state body and you can get de-identified administrative data, might be another way where you lessen the concern of an IRB about the type of data that you'll be collecting and the risks.
Well, thank you. Give us just a minute while we change the guard here and bring up the next group of presenters.
I'm going to introduce now Chris Gordon, who is the moderator for our last panel this morning. Thank you.
Well, thanks again to OBSSR for really taking the leadership role. It's been an exciting morning already, and it's really fun and a privilege to be a part of this cross-cutting discussion across many different disease areas. I'm Chris Gordon, and I'm the branch chief for secondary HIV prevention and translational research at NIMH. And as part of the planning committee, I was delighted to volunteer to moderate this next exciting panel. We have three great talks this morning, leading off with Mary Jane Rutherford Boris, then Marcy Campbell from University of North Carolina, and Jonathan Tobin from the Clinical Directors Network. And as well, I will dispense with much introduction to maximize their speaking time and question and answer, and just say that I've been fortunate to work with both Mary Jane and Jonathan over the last few years on their work, and delighted to read more about Marcy's work in preparations for this conference. And each is a very accomplished scientist, and you'll find they have a keen sense of both the practical issues of their interventions for individuals, as well as an understanding of the big picture in trying to maximize the impact of their work and really affect the diseases in their communities. So thanks for your attention, and we'll start with Mary Jane.
Thanks, Chris. It's really an honor to be here today. But as a scientist, I come to the issue of diffusion of evidence-based interventions kind of like a tourist coming to Washington. And a couple years ago, I remember I started to head downtown to visit the Smithsonian. And after I'd gone about a half an hour, I finally found a gas station. And I stopped and I said, "How far to the Smithsonian?" Guy looked at me and he goes, "Well, about 24,996 miles. But if you turn around and go the other way, 4 miles down the road." And as a scientist, I feel that if we keep on the current road that we're going on, I'm headed in the wrong direction, or it's going to take me a very long time to hit that goal. But that today I want to talk about the possibility of business being one strategy that would help us turn around and hit our goal faster. We're actually here today because we're under a congressional mandate. Congress in the future is going to demand accountability from us and only going to fund evidence-based programs. It's not unique to the United States. The UK, Australia, and the major international donors, World Health Organization, have adopted the same stance. And as scientists, we heard our first speaker, Grimshaw, today talk about 5,000 health services evidence-based programs. Well, I'm a prevention researcher. Most of my work has been in HIV. But if you look at prevention of child and family programs, in 1987, from the 30s to the 80s, by 1987, there were only 14 evidence-based interventions with one-year follow-up data. Today, there are hundreds. We've responded, and these programs have been developed. Yet, providers and consumers aren't using them. Peter Jensen in press has estimated 1% penetration rate. Federal agencies, like the Centers for Disease Control, are mandating that the community-based agencies that they fund use evidence-based prevention programs. I have one of their evidence-based prevention programs. At one of the agencies that was funded to replicate my program, first session out, there was a formal burning of our manual in a trash can called the bait and switch strategy. It's even harder since the norms of our science are that we have replication with fidelity. Well, what exactly is that supposed to be replication of? Is it to the scripts, it to the activities, to the timing, to when the bathroom breaks are, is this mandated in some manuals? Or, in fact, is it to some core element and constructs? We're not so clear. And what I would argue is that as scientists, if we're going to meet this congressional mandate, we're going to have to be like those participants on the Extreme Makeover show on TV. We need an extreme makeover. We have the basic potential to be shining and diffused, but if we don't change how we're doing what we're doing, we're never going to make it. And actually, I'm going to argue that what I'm going to say in the next 10 minutes is exactly what we heard John Morgenstern say, only I'm going to present a different alternative. He focused on policy interventions. I want to focus on integrating business scientists, us, integrating business models into the design, delivery, and dissemination of evidence-based interventions. And that together, science and business may dramatically shift program design, delivery, and evidence-based diffusion. I don't expect this to be a popular idea, because I know, based on our research, 97% of you guys in the audience are liberal, 74% Democrats. And that's actually a huge barrier to our adoption and our diffusion of our intervention. Because if we turn over, you can look at business. Business creates programs that providers and consumers use. Business penetrates markets. And I want to spend a couple minutes here to give us a little contrast effect into what we've heard earlier today. We've got obesity epidemic in the United States. The average child in America goes to McDonald's 3.5 times per week. McDonald's owns the biggest owner of parks and playing fields in the world. Let's take baby Einstein, founded in 1997. That's right, only 10 years. And if it was a research project, we wouldn't have yet finished our second randomized controlled trial that would be a standard of evidence that it's okay. But in the last 10 years, baby Einstein, starting with a budget of $18,000, is now a $200 million operation and was bought out 3 years after its inception by Disney. And that in the year 2005, there's now, called Little Einsteins, an entire TV station devoted to it, despite the fact that the American Academy of Pediatrics came out and said, these are bad for you. 6% of Americans know that these programs are bad, that the American Academy of Pediatrics came out. 49% of Americans, or enough to hit the tipping point, believe that these programs increase your kids' cognitive development, despite the fact that 2 months ago, Fred Zimmerman came out with well-documented evidence that, in fact, kids who use these programs have 8 fewer words and that the most damage is done from 8 to 16 months of age. They are beating us at our game every step of the way. Another example, American Girl, founded in 1987, the same year that we had 14 evidence-based programs with one-year follow-up. They came out. This is now this only reaches 650,000 households a month. And actually, American Girl has done something better. Since my evidence-based program starting, this just shows how old I am, in the mid-70s, each one of them has used a feeling thermometer. American Girl has a whole book on feeling thermometers that's attractive and interesting and has sold 110 million of these books. I don't think I could find, I had one of those 14-based evidence-based programs, children's assertiveness training. I never did a replication. I don't think I can find 5 people in the United States using it. But American Girl is hitting 110 million books. They are beating us at our game. They know how to diffuse interventions. Let's learn from them. How do they do it? Number one, their programs are market-driven, not theory-driven. We heard all morning how we have to have better theories. Yeah, maybe. I think we have some really good theories. We got evidence-based programs. But we don't know anything about our market, nor do we design to our market. And when I want to know how to compete with American Girl, I went online. You know how much it costs a new business? It could cost you $50,000, but it takes you about 10 days to find out. The federal government would save so much money if we, there is no Hart Hanks market intelligence on any of our provider groups, whether it's in health services organizations, community-based agencies, in schools. We don't have it, nor do we have it for consumers. We heard data this morning about how researchers view and assess organizational climate, but we don't go to the horse's mouth to say, what do you want? How could you do it? What are the limits and capacity? And design our programs out of the gate so they were actually tailored to the capacity of those people. Actually, our consumers are generally institutions. Business programs are robust, and they know what about their programs are robust because they do iterative prototypes over time. Almost every single speaker this morning talked about the failures of our biomedical phase 1-4 or phase 1-6. I don't want to care how you want to frame it, but everybody agrees it's not working. And when we go from our hothouse research environment to the real world, we start hitting problems that we never intended. We heard about the REAIM. Our group's is cures. We think that there should be a whole different criteria to fund out of NIH. You have to be a cure from the gate, cost-effective, some idea that it's going to be useful, that it is, you know what's robust about your program, it's allowed to evolve over time, and it's sustainable, and that you have some hope to hit those criteria, or we're not going into phase one trials. We don't imitate, in a way, Deming's model, which allowed the Japanese to catch up with us in terms of auto manufacturing in less than 20 years and beat us at that game. We could use that model to improve and shape evidence-based interventions out of the gate so that they would be likely to succeed. And the third way that businesses do that is that they design programs out of the gate to be easy and desirable to access and used repeatedly over time. About 7 years ago, Willa Pequinot's here today, I saw her. She and I co-chaired an NIMH intervention work group. And we said, there's really invisible nested outcomes in each of our evidence-based programs. You got to do three things. You got to get them there, then you change behavior, and you got to maintain it over time. Our research designs, until we get to phase four, we don't worry about getting them there because we're just going to pay them to get them in the door because we're about proof of concept. And we haven't tried 200 different iterations before the time we get there. We've tried three, maybe. Well, business designs that it's not getting out of there unless you can hit all three outcomes out of the gate. We don't design for easy access. We don't design for sustainability, and our models are different. I think we could diffuse more evidence-based programs more broadly by integrating business into our design practice. We got plenty of models where scientists goes to business. That's why we can't hire any statisticians. Pharmaceutical companies are paying them $20,000 more out of the gate than we can ever pay. But we have some really impressive examples of what happens when scientists go to business around prevention outcomes. Sesame Street. Scientists and creativity, but it wasn't in academia. Everybody left. It's the most researched and considered to be the biggest intervention that's had an impact on kids' cognitive development in the last 30 years. Second, Weight Watchers. Most people don't know that Richard Stewart, to me, you know, college student in the 70s, he was the god of American Association of Behavior Therapy. Fat in a Thin World, evidence-based principles designed Weight Watchers. It's changed, it's adapted, it's changed over the years, but in fact, it's being used and it hits the best of cognitive behavioral therapy. We've heard a lot about pipelines. I think we need synthesized cutting-edge science and a pulse on the market for both consumers and who are end users and providers, and that we need a new design zone. The scientific pipeline, we heard about the Cochrane Collaborative this morning, and my group personally wants to become the health promotion in the U.S. Version of the Cochrane Collaborative, but those analyses are limited because they're based on what our theories, the only things we assessed are what we believed were the mediators and moderators, but what we do is much more than what we say and what's in our theories. And unless we do content reviews of our evidence-based programs, Delphi processes, and expert panels, my area is HIV, and we've looked at HIV evidence-based programs, and we say everybody does the same thing. I can tell you 10 principles. It reads like everything I know I learned in kindergarten, that that every single evidence-based program says be prepared. For HIV, that means carry a condom in your pocket. But I'll guarantee you, when our group does the analysis of evidence-based programs for obesity, every single program says be prepared. If you don't know what you're going to eat and you don't have access to it, it's not happening. That there are common factors across every evidence-based intervention, and that there are common processes. There's some variability, and there's some that they're the same, but we got to focus much more on what's the same than what's different. For providers and consumers, we also, though, need a pipeline. We need NIH to fund a national panel like the Hart-Hanks National Panel with marketing information on providers and consumers. We do not have any real-time data collection. YouTube and MySpace are out there every day. My group, this week, we won the Robert Wood Johnson Disruptive Innovations idea. And we had to get a mobilization team. We had a Facebook page, a YouTube. We rose by a factor of 20, which might say how low the base rate was, the hits on our website within a week by just very simple interventions. We're not rewarded as researchers for diffusing and disseminating. Again, other people know how to do it differently. And when we get that pipeline, in no theory that I know about is inspiration anywhere. That's a key part. What are the problems consumers care about, and what's acceptable and attractive to consumers? We think that we need design zones in universities, in our science-based organizations that have both scientists and marketers to design the programs, and that when they come together, this is not going to be a pretty picture. I brought in a co-director from the private enterprise world about 3 years ago, and I feel bloodied. And you better believe that the norms in science, which are, you know what, we beat each other up, the best ideas survive, and let's go at it. You know, creative people, they like don't like that. How are they? I noticed before that secretaries didn't like it either. But that the first lesson in business is that we have to design and open our culture up to new and different ideas. And one of the, going back to what business does that we don't do, is that they brand their interventions to penetrate markets. There is no Aboriginal in the middle of Australia or Mongol up above Ulaanbaatar in Mongolia that does not know about Coca-Cola or McDonald's. What they brand on is inspiration, and they appeal to our emotions. What do we brand on? Our publications, how long they are, and the letters after our name. It's not going to work. And that when they use to introduce new products, they can build on that track record in a way that we as scientists can never build on our track record. So the iPod telephone is an instant success because of the iPod. We need a national brand for prevention. And, you know, me as a scientist, I design it. This is what it looks like. I guarantee it wouldn't look that way if business designed it. Business diffuses things broadly. They give us choices about delivery formats. Harry Potter came out. You could get a book, you could get a DVD, you could get an audio tape, you could get clothes that is like it. Nothing on TV, it was on 15 different channels for a week. We do not know and that when they do it, they monitor utilization and they adapt their programs over time. We need delivery vehicles. Right now, there's 700-minute clinics going in pharmacies all over the United States. Who's lined up against it? Physicians. Who's lined up for it? Nurses and the 98% satisfaction of everybody who's going in there and getting service by them. Our group is focusing on coaching clinics in shopping malls. And we want to take existing evidence-based interventions designed for schools or healthcare centers, and we want to put them in shopping malls and make them available for parents. Our understanding will only happen if we have a science of delivery formats. And the best we get are we try one program and do it two different ways. What was robust about them, what wasn't, we don't know. We need a quality improvement paradigm rather than our phase 1 to 4. Where does this lead us? Our current scientists' current models, we fail to broadly disseminate evidence-based programs. Providers and consumers that utilize business principles create and they distribute and they penetrate markets. We need to think out of the box of our current ways of designing evidence-based programs. We need to integrate business strategies into the design and the delivery process so that we can meet the needs of providers and consumers with higher quality and less time. In closing, I would just say my career is kind of reflected in what Kenneth Johnston said. He described education as coming from cocksure ignorance to thoughtful uncertainty. I've conducted, in the last 15 years, 12 randomized controlled trials, several national multi-site trials, several international multi-site trials, some with 15,000 published in JAMA, published in Lancet, published in Science, not being used anywhere. And certainly not by our government and the $3 billion a year that they're spending for HIV prevention globally. That in the last 20 years, my career has been like the teacher that the principal was criticizing after watching the teacher in the classroom, and he said, well, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, and the teacher goes, hey, wait, I've got 20 years experience. Well, no, you don't have 20 years experience, said the principal. You have 1 year experience 20 times. That's what I've done on my 12 randomized controlled trials. I only have about 10 years left in my career. I want to have an impact. And I think that if I could bring business to science, that we could do, I could do much more in the next 10 years in an evolving paradigm that looks to where other people know how to do it better than us and that we're not the smartest kid on the block that only talks to each other. Thank you.
Is anyone else craving McDonald's right now? Marcy, please tell us how you've overcome this with your dietary change interventions.
Well, I'm sure everybody is hungry at this point. And I'm going to tell a little bit of a different story, which really is how did a public health researcher who never intended to do dissemination research end up feeling that, very similar to Mary Jane, that that's how I want to spend the rest of my career, trying to get some evidence-based interventions into practice. So many of us in public health find ourselves getting grants, doing efficacy testing, doing randomized trials, beautiful factorial designs, and discovering things that actually work and have effect sizes that are pretty good. And then we are faced with writing the next grant? Do we just drop what we did? Or is there some way to figure out what to do with it? And I'm going to tell a couple stories about this. So some of the questions are, as we've already discussed this morning, once you do the intervention, hopefully you've designed it for dissemination so that it has potential. And that's very, very important, as we've heard. And then we often start looking around thinking about, okay, well, we had this good study with internal validity, but what populations and settings now would benefit from this intervention? And very quickly we start thinking, okay, so we're going to have to partner with somebody to do this. Because very often we in public health, we're really good at getting grants and, you know, recruiting and participants in studies, but we don't have the resources then to spread something on a broader basis, and partners often do. And then this question of who's supposed to fund it at that point. And I want to make a point that institutional commitment, for those of us in academia who are, you know, have to get tenure and have to move our careers forward and have to publish and so forth, that dissemination has not been very well respected as a way to do those things until recently. And so you really have to have the institutional commitment and support of the place that you work to be able to launch into doing dissemination research. And John Kerner suggested that, that I mention this, but I am fortunate to be at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where our Comprehensive Cancer Center managed to get funded the first dissemination core as part of our last core grant renewal. And so we actually have a core whose mission it is to provide expertise and mentorship and help with adapting products of those of us ivory tower public health researchers so that we can move forward with dissemination. And this has really been very, very helpful and actually has allowed us to be awarded two R01s now on the diffusion and implementation program announcement. And I don't think we would have been able to do that without it. And one of the things that the Dissemination Corps also tries to do is to help connect researchers with partners. So, I mean, I think that's one way to start to overcome this sort of 17-year gap between from discovery to dissemination is to try to create some structures that will facilitate that connection so that we may not get it out, you know, next year, but at least after the efficacy study is done, people have an idea of where to go and how to move. So I just want to, again, because I kind of think stories are more interesting before lunch than we've heard some wonderful talks now on theory and methods, to talk about two sort of exemplar models of how we are doing dissemination of evidence-based interventions. And I'm going to talk about Body and Soul, in which the partners have been two universities, actually three, because one person moved to another university, American Cancer Society and NCI. And the funding has primarily come from the government for this one, and also Foundation, American Cancer Society. And then the other example is the R01 that we just were awarded under the DNI program announcement, which is an obesity prevention management program in which we're partnering with actually the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. And again, of course, the funding for the R01 is through NCI, but the VA is also providing a lot of funds and resources as well as infrastructure and the promise of a huge national dissemination. So some of you may know about Body and Soul. This is the manual, just a nice photo of it. Body and Soul developed out of two R01 projects, Black Churches United for Better Health, which occurred in North Carolina, and Eat for Life, which was Ken Resnikow's project at Emory University. And both of those were, although they included a lot of community-based formative research and so forth, were essentially randomized control trials to see if we could increase fruit and vegetable consumption and improve dietary behavior among African-American church members. They used different strategies, which I won't go into now. Once those programs are over, at least I can speak for black churches, we actually wrote a continuation grant, which was nerfed, and we thought, you know, this program is going to sit on the shelf and we'll move on to the next thing. And the state health department was attempting in a small way to do dissemination. Until literally one day I got a telephone call and it was Rebecca Mullis, some of you may know, on the phone saying, guess what? American Cancer Society had a blue ribbon panel and we've identified your program as exemplary and we want to disseminate it. And so this was sort of the serendipitous approach to dissemination, which we haven't really talked about, where we didn't think we were going to get to disseminate and we were picked. However, the catch was we had to agree, which was no problem, to collaborate with the researchers who did Eat for Life, identify the essential elements, and turn it into a program that ACS would like to disseminate. And NCI said, if you do that, we will fund research to evaluate it. And I will tell you that that was not easy. We had both done process evaluations and mediation analyses, and we both had our sets of things that we were convinced were essential. How did we decide on the essential elements? We basically decided it in the fourth floor of the Atlanta Hartsfield Airport. We had meetings up there, and we hashed it out, and we horse traded, and we decided what would go into Body and Soul. So it wasn't really theory-driven. It was really a combination of what we knew from our research worked and what ACS thought was compatible with their values and what they could deliver. The effectiveness trial results, as I said, both showed that there were changes in fruit and vegetable consumption. Oh, I'm sorry. This is the Body and Soul effectiveness trial now. So we did another study of Body and Soul as disseminated by the American Cancer Society. It was effective. There was evidence of sustainability. We did a process evaluation. All that's been published. And basically, at that point, ACS stepped back and said, we're not sure we're ready to move to full dissemination. NCI said, we will pick up Body and Soul. And it is now in a national dissemination. And you can, any church in the country can go to the Body and Soul website or can call the 1-800 for cancer phone number. And all the materials are downloadable. There's a program manual, there's a DVD training program, materials, graphics, cookbooks, et cetera. And we're now in the phase of, with CDC funding, evaluating that level of disseminated program. How does it work when the churches do the program without any researcher involvement at all? And NCI is also doing other research on that. So that's sort of an example of how we've taken the program from efficacy to dissemination. And we're still working on it, and it's been a number of years, but I'm excited about it because it is moving forward. And hopefully, someday we will really see some effect throughout the population. The other project I want to just talk about briefly is the R01. And actually, after hearing the talks this morning, there are a lot of people I want to talk to who know a lot more about the VA and the query system and so forth than I do. So this has been very useful. But this project is a partnership with the VA, specifically through the VA National Center for Health Promotion, which is based in Durham, North Carolina. And the VA has an obesity treatment program that's clinic-based called MOVE, which is some acronym for Managing Overweight and Obesity for Veterans Everywhere. And we just briefly have proposed, and I'll show you where it came from, to test the dissemination of an enhanced version of that program called MOVE Vets. And VET stands for Veteran Education and Tailored Self-Management. So the VETS part is really tailored materials and peer counseling by veteran volunteers. This grew out of an R01, a Health Communication and Cancer Control R01, called NC Strides, where we tested tailored print materials and motivational interviewing as a way of doing home-based interventions with older adults to improve health behaviors and prevent colon cancer. This is a large project team. So the tailored intervention was four newsletters, and I won't go into how tailoring works. And the motivational intervention was four telephone calls by trained counselors. And essentially, the results showed that the combining of tailored print communications and motivational interviewing produced double the effect of each intervention independently compared to a control condition. And we also did a cost-effectiveness analysis. And we found that either the tailored print alone or the combined interventions were the most cost effective. And we then started talking to the VA, again, a serendipitous connection because I went, Linda Kinsinger, who's head of the VA, National Center for Health Promotion, graduated from UNC. We were talking, and she said, we would really like to do something with you. We applied for and got a diffusion and dissemination supplement to pilot doing this tailored newsletter and motivational interviewing intervention in two VA sites. We replicated the original findings, and then we wrote the R01. We also measured weight loss and found weight loss. And just, you know, many of you know this, but I was, you know, really excited to think about partnering with the VA because of the size, because of the scope, the deservingness of the population, high prevalence of risk factors, and the fact that they were really ready to innovate. This is just showing that we have, you know, a partnership that includes many people from both the university and the VA. And what we're going to do is we're doing organizational assessment. We are cherry picking sites based on readiness to work with MOVE and to work with us. And we're adapting our intervention now for dissemination within the VA system so that once we're done, everything will live in the VA firewall and so forth and can be delivered by the VA without us. We're then going to do a randomized controlled trial, but with each VA site as a unit of randomization and analysis. And we're using REAIM, and we're also using Wagner's chronic care model as our models. Just a word on adapting for dissemination. Everything always has to be adapted, as was mentioned previously. Nothing ever stays the same, and I think that's part of the fun of it. And so we're doing focus groups right now, this week in San Antonio, and we're doing around the country to try to figure out better ways of doing tailoring to fit the values and the context and so forth of the VA population. We've also developed an automated web-to-print delivery system for the tailored newsletters so that they can be delivered by the VA without difficulty. And the biggest challenge is integrating all that behind the VA firewall and with their IT issues that are going on now. The peer counselor training program partly grew out of our interest in peer counseling with Body and Soul and partly out of an interest of the VA and CP to have a role for returning vets from Iraq and Afghanistan and to develop what they're calling a veteran volunteer corps to give people a purpose. And the idea of training on MI and peer counseling was very appealing. So we're creating a training DVD for that purpose. And we're going to launch the study soon. And then this is my final slide, just shows you an example of adapting tailored print to the VA context and using values is one of the things we tailor on from MI, but things look very different in this study than they did when we were working with African American church members, for example, but the basic principles and theories are still the same. Okay, thank you. Oh, conclusions. Sorry. Okay, anyway, I didn't really do that to get applause twice, but dissemination is really, really important. We don't know as public health researchers how to disseminate. We need help. Things like dissemination cores and partnerships are critical. And I will add business models are good too. And we really need to, you know, as many people have said, find better ways to optimize our products for dissemination. And we need institutional support. And we also appreciate the support of NIH to fund these projects. Okay, thank you. Thank you.